Amber Barrett. 10 for the Republic of Ireland. Amber Barrett from 4 yards out.
OTB live commentary. Never miss the action right here on OTB Sports Radio.
OTB.
With Gillette, put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
It's bang on 7:30. It's Thursday morning. It feels like it's been a very long week. I don't know what it's been like for you out there. Wherever you are in the world watching or listening to us this morning, you're very welcome along. You can text the show on 0879 180 180. You can leave a comment on the YouTube stream. You can get us at Off The Ball AM on our Twitter feed. Owen's back. Owen, good morning to you.
Good morning, Ger. How are things?
You were humiliated in your absence. You finished third in a race of three where you'd been like leading at one point, I think.
Yeah, complete capitulation is what happened.
Did you shave the moustache in protest? Is it gone?
I did, but today's the 2nd of December. I was going to take a picture yesterday and send it in and say this is what I could have had. This is what you could have had as your winner.
Yeah.
And I just forgot to do it. I was like, it's the 2nd of December. That would be a little bit pathetic.
So what did you... Is that the same moustache you had the whole time? You haven't trimmed it or anything?
No, I've trimmed it down, yeah.
Oh, you have trimmed it down.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Why'd you do that?
To bring everything level again and not try and cling on to this for too long. Just to...
What's wrong with that, Owen? What's wrong with that?
Well, I'm not the winner here. I guess why would I want to hold on to something which had me finishing third in a three-horse race, which I was leading at the very start? It's a complete collapse and I'm humiliated and rightly so. I will protest this.
A goblet of minor prestige.
Yeah, like, so what does Adrian get for winning this, actually?
Nothing,
okay.
Bragging rights, which obviously don't really want to give Adrian too many bragging rights because he'll brag about them.
Yeah, well, he certainly will. It's probably the greatest achievement by any moustache in the history of Irish moustaches ever. Really.
Might be, yeah. After a few glasses of wine, it certainly becomes that. Right, it is 7:32. We've actually got a very busy programme for you. Ron O'Gara is going to join us a little bit later on. We're going to talk to Ars Blog about Arsenal against Manchester United tonight. Just because you were all protesting that we did too much Man United this week when they, you know, eventually got round to sacking their manager, a club legend, and replacing him with one of the most interesting characters in world football at the moment, who we don't know if it's going to be a success or not. So, you know, I make no apologies for covering the story the way we did. But we will obviously talk about Liverpool and Everton last night. We'll talk about Manchester City and Everton. We'll talk about the returning are they Munster heroes from South Africa and what happens now. And we'll also talk about Harry Byrne with Ronan O'Gara and whatever you're having as well, plenty more, including Denise O'Sullivan is going to talk to us after the Ireland game the other night, where she was absolutely sensational as well. So where do you want to start? Do we start with the end of Rafa Benitez before it's even begun? Is this the end?
I'm not sure it is. I think that certainly the feeling at the end of the game last night was sack the board. That was the voice coming through. Of course, that's not how this happens. The board will sack the manager and the board will keep themselves in position. But it's not just the likes of Bill Kenwright, who you're like looking awkwardly at, who had this sort of wry smile after one of the goals was conceded last night, which probably didn't look too good. But it's also someone like Marcel Brands, who was sitting two seats over from him, and his recruitment that I'm sure is under the microscope. Like, you can make a case that Benitez has got unlucky since the start of the season when they started pretty well. It was their best start to a season since 2004-05. And then since then, Dominic Calvert-Lewin has gone down, Yerry Mina has gone down, Abdoulaye Doucouré has gone down, has come back. But getting Mina and getting Calvert-Lewin back over the next little while is going to be central to Benitez keeping his job. I think it's just a little bit too soon for him to be shown the door just yet. But if these results continue once they're back to full strength, he's doomed, obviously, because last night was humiliating.
I think their fixtures are pretty bad. They were listing off the fixtures. So it's Arsenal next. It's Arsenal, Palace away, Chelsea away, Leicester City at home, Burnley away, and then at the end of December is Newcastle at home. So, you know, there are points in that period between now and New Year's Eve that they could pick up, and I think a lot will depend on Dominic Calvert-Lewin coming back and being in form straight away. Is he? I don't know what his record is like coming straight back from injury, so we'll see. I do wonder if fans are now articulate and smart enough to realise that chanting for Benitez to be sacked doesn't work, but chanting for the board to get sacked gets the board's attention. That's the type of thing that, like, oh, it happened at Spurs, right? We want Ray Levy. And then anytime they do that, the manager gets sacked. It's like, I gave you what I want. Thumb up, thumb down. He's like sitting there like a Roman emperor. Is that what the Everton fans, have they've copped this too? It's like, what's the point in giving out about Benitez? Like, if we do that, the board are completely like, I don't care. he's a Operation Human Shield. Whereas we start going after them,
Yeah.
I mean, obviously not physically going after them before everybody gets... but sometimes you need to say this. And that's it. Is that what happens? Is that the end of... Like, would that accelerate things? Because the point about the recruitment, right? They have no money. It's tied up in the amount of money that they've already wasted in recent seasons. So they find themselves in a difficult situation.
You see, I think it's just Groundhog Day for them, isn't it? I think there's been as many managers as there has been years of the Farhad Moshiri era at Everton. So it could just be a sense of deja vu that we have been here before. We know that we will get rid of the manager if we go the way of every other club, and we know that we will have a bad spell next year where Seamus Coleman has come out once again in front of the microphones and say this is just unacceptable, this is not a good performance, or it'll be a different manager that's not called Rafa Benitez who is staring down the barrel of, you know, being in 15th position going into Christmas. This is nothing new from Everton's standpoint, so I think it's as much to do with that. Like, it's obviously quite funny last night seeing the fans leave after 20 minutes, turn around to the away fans and give them the fingers and all that sort of thing. And I always kind of think about those fans when the game starts to turn a little bit, when they get an equaliser out of nothing. And I'm like, if you've left the game early and you're an Everton fan, you are absolutely hoping to God that they don't equalise, that they don't
get hammered. Yeah.
Yeah, like, I mean, what a strange place to be as a fan. You're like, you've paid for your ticket to see the Merseyside derby, probably not cheap, probably season ticket holders, and all of a sudden you're rooting against your team outside, all for the sake of walking out angrily and losing the head completely. So I don't know what the point is there, but the point is that there's a lot of people who lost their head inside the ground last night, and still the prevailing theme was sack the board rather than Rafa.
Were they right though to leave after 20 minutes? I mean, it looked like it was going to be 6 or 7 nil, right? And then they get back into it briefly against the run of play largely, and then it finishes 4-1 and it could have been 7. Were they right? I mean, I think you should never leave. I think you should support your team to the end. That's my own view. But like, in their minds, were they justified in the end? It's like, oh, I was right.
Well, it was. The first 20 minutes was looking like Ireland, Georgia, really, to be honest. And you've just thought, there's no way. I saw someone even on Twitter being like, this is going to get to Liverpool versus United level. I'm like, that's such an understatement. This is so much worse than Liverpool United level. This is on a level completely above that. And then maybe when Everton get that goal back, if you're a Liverpool fan, you start thinking to yourself, geez, what's actually happened here that we're in this position where we're not feeling totally comfortable? Because they destroyed them over the first few minutes. I think, was it Jonathan Wilson this morning who said that in the first 10 minutes, Liverpool racked up a higher XG than Everton had done in total in 4 of their games this season. 10 minutes is all Liverpool needed to do that at Goodison Park. And it should have been a lot more than 2 goals or whatever it was after 10 minutes.
Was it 1-0?
It was 1-0
after,
yeah, 10 minutes.
The second doesn't come to about half an hour, I think.
Right. Last time was a really interesting night because you have City and Chelsea also playing.
Yeah.
Granted, the opposition that both teams were up against, it seemed, weren't as hapless as Everton were for the first half an hour of that game last night. But it's interesting judging all the different parts of these teams going toe-to-toe as it is for this title this year. There's a lot about Liverpool that you like from last night, and there's a big case to be made that they can absolutely go all the way.
Last night was one of those nights where it genuinely is the best league in the world. Like, we haven't talked about Silva's goal yet, which is unbelievable.
Absolutely ridiculous.
Now, I want to just complain about the fact that there isn't a goals show, that Amazon spent all this money to get all the games, and you can flick through, and Premier have the same deal in Ireland, obviously, that Amazon have. So if you were watching last night in Ireland, you were watching on Premier Sports, but Amazon just needs to put on a goals show so that we can sit there on a night like last night and watch what's happening. There were too many games. They have the technology. They've seen the success of it with BT Sports. Mm. They've got the rights to do it. That's the thing that would convince everybody to get Amazon or Premier in this case. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
They have to provide it in England before Premier can get it in Ireland. It's like, I actually missed in real time the Silva goal because I was flicking over to see Everton get the shit kicked out of them. It was like, there's too much football on for me to be able to. And then I was like, I missed this.
And then you have like little things like James Maddison's goal last night for Leicester City, which was an absolute corker.
The overhead bicycle kick from Mope to equalise for Brighton. An overhead bicycle kick not even in the top 3 goals maybe last night.
No, Jota's was number 1.
Silva's is, I think, one of the goals of the season because they're pricking around in the right back spot, and it looks like Villa, when I saw the highlights, it's like, oh, are Villa going to score from here? Because it comes from a Villa attack.
Mm.
And there's bad head tennis being played in the right back position between, is it Fernandinho and somebody? And you're like, oh, just press them. Go on. And unfortunately, they do. And then it's like ping, 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 ping. Ooh. Whoa.
That
That team's good.
Yeah, and as you say, one of the best goals that City have scored in recent years, it should be the hallmark of a dominant performance. And I think this is, in fairness, a lot down to Villa as well. That could so easily have been a point for Villa last night, especially with the Chukwuemeka chance late on in the game, when Emi Buendia, who, by the way, it looks like a different player under Steven Gerrard, finds an angle that wasn't even visible on television, never mind on the pitch where he was. And if he puts that past the keeper, it's 2-2, and all of a sudden it's Aston Villa on 7 points from the Steven Gerrard reign so far, in an incredible position. So I think that all, like, you can compare the Chelsea, maybe the lack of ruthlessness, or maybe the lack, well, I guess the lack of creativity from Chelsea's perspective last night, maybe City not putting Villa to the sword with Liverpool. But I think last night Everton were just weaker of the three opponents, and that has to be taken into account.
Look, it could easily have been 4-0 to City after the first 5 minutes. Mm. They were absolutely dominant. They just came out and was like, yeah, we are men, you are boys, and we are going to steal everything that you have today. And in fairness, Villa kind of stuck in there and weren't completely out of the game at 2-0, although it did look like that could have gone 4-0. And then Villa scored, started the second half, and it does change the game a little bit. But yeah, you know, you've got to be pretty excited about the impact that Gerrard is having. He's given the kids game time. He's given players who are completely ostracised game time. He's gone back to a back four where the team gives up chances, but like, everybody has to be responsible, except when Matty Target ducks out of the way of the first goal where Diaz scores.
I think that's actually one of the more underrated elements, I know we're hopping around here, of the Liverpool game last night, is that from Salah's final goal, when Seamus Coleman obviously messes up, it comes from an Everton corner, and the Everton corner comes from an Andros Townsend free kicks, which just hits Matip right in the face, and Matip even kind of like just puts his head up a little bit just to take the ball right flush in the face and
that's
over
the difference.
Barrett's head. Like, I mean, it's one of those little things that do make a massive difference, and I think we all know it at this stage, it's nothing new, but once you are taking a corner against Liverpool, you were in grave danger unless you're keeping a few bodies back, and that's exactly what happened. In fairness, it was kind of like Sancho's goal for United at the weekend, Salah's goal on that occasion, except Jorginho's replaced by Seamus Coleman on this occasion, and the missed control touch is just, it's a terrible, terrible moment if you're up against the quality of a player like Sancho or Mo Salah in this case.
We should start the rumour that Jorginho was getting the Ballon d'Or until that actually happened, and they were like, sorry, you've done this 24 hours out from the ceremony and we just can't have it. So they rang Messi, stick your kids in the tuxes, come on in. You're not really supposed to get this, but we fixed it. There was an error in the voting. The Stokes Kennedy Crowley lads, they were like, sorry, they've discovered some irregularities here.
What was the OTB reaction to that, actually? Like, was it Messi all the way? Was it Lewandowski camp here?
I'm not that, I don't really
care.
I mean, a bit. Like, I feel like last season was Lewandowski's season. Miguel on Twitter was making the point that, like, Lewandowski didn't play after the quarterfinals of the Champions League. He wins a league. He beats up on the kids in the Bundesliga that, you know, they'll win league games 7-8, 9-0, whatever. And that Messi won a Copa America. Like, because the Copa America is not on TV, like, day in, day out in this part of the world, we're like, that's not important. It doesn't really matter. But, like, it's the Euros for a giant continent where the best football that has ever been played was invented. Is that not important a little bit? It probably is important.
Yeah, there's also probably a case to be made that there's a lot more about a season than just actually winning the trophies. And just because, I don't know, N'Golo Kanté didn't win the Euros this year doesn't necessarily make his contribution to Chelsea's Champions League charge all important.
It was more important than you would have said Jorginho, right?
I would say so.
Because he was man of the match in both legs of the semi-final.
And obviously with Italy, it's just he ticks the couple of boxes. But we digress a small bit here, I think. Like, I mean, the Ballon d'Or is... I think the Lewandowski thing was also a sense of justice for 2020, because he was absolutely the player of 2020, and maybe there is more of an argument about it this year about him potentially not getting it.
I'm just trying to look. So when do we give it to Salah though?
That's the question now, because he is the best player in the world.
What is the actual voting period?
The voting period, you're putting me on the spot here, is calendar, is it not?
But it's November. And the votes
December
would have been cast.
Mustaches are gone. Is it just the start of December 1st, 2020? I don't know, is the honest answer to this question. I should know. Being well informed in the Ballon d'Or is clearly highly important. I don't know what the sort of period is, but I had always assumed it was the calendar year.
You keep talking amongst yourself
at which point Mo Salah hasn't even begun his candidacy for next year. Well, although last night was the 1st of December, so he has got off to a flying start for next year's.
Or else it doesn't count. Maybe just the month of December doesn't count. This is
irrelevant.
This is like doing your best work the week after the Oscars come out of it. Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter irrelevant. At all. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Possibly. So next year when we get to the Ballon d'Or, there will be no major tournament to actually decide it on, given the World Cup is so late in the year. So, I guess there's probably a bit more of a recency bias if Salah does pick up the award, but still, you see him playing the football he's playing at the moment, and it's hard to argue that he's not the best footballer in the world, and it would be a bit of a shame if he didn't pick up a Ballon d'Or at this point. His run of form this season has been that good.
Yeah, he was nominated. I didn't see how many votes he got. Anyway, look, so we'll move on from the bore of the Ballon d'Or, where none of us are that excited that we don't actually know the specifics of it. Somebody out there, I'm sure, will be able to drop us a line on the YouTube channel and talk to us about that. Is there anything else about the football last night you want to talk about?
The really exciting thing from last night is obviously the fact that it's kind of like not rubber stamping, because we won't know until the end of the season, but this real sense that this is going to be a three-horse race. And like, I think most Liverpool fans would admit that when you compare their team's depth to that of Manchester City, when Pep Guardiola is not complaining and everybody's fit, and that of Chelsea's, Liverpool possibly don't have the squad that those two teams have. So if we want to pick, as a neutral, we want to pick one of these three horses right now to be flying and to be potentially putting their noses in front and in the best vein of form, we want that to be Liverpool. So I think last night is a good development from a neutral perspective on actually getting a proper three-horse race all the way. It's interesting, like, listening to Klopp as well after the game. Like, when Klopp comes into the club, he absolutely taps into the cop. He taps into the history of the club, the emotion of the club. And I'm not sure, is it a reaction to the empty stadiums last year or to the poor form last year? But it seems that he's tried to move away from that. And speaking afterwards, he says that he's never seen his team as calm and convinced, was the phrase he used, in terms of winning a game against one of the big clubs. And of course, for them, one of the big clubs would be Everton, given the rivalry. And he says we need the right mindset. Emotion is good, but it's not the all important thing. Whereas it felt that in the past, emotion was essentially what Liverpool feasted on, and now they can still channel that in the right way. But maybe there's a bit of a coldness to Liverpool this year, and it may be a bit more of a clinical nature to them that we haven't seen in the past. Which again kind of points towards the fact that they're going to stay the trip, and that we will have the three of them there. Do you have a little bit of concern for Chelsea maybe on the back of last night?
I've been wavering about this the whole way along. I was like, what's going to happen? Are they going to find form as a forward running team? I think stuff like last night probably gives them more confidence, because this is where they would have dropped points over the last couple of seasons when they weren't winning titles. Best league in the world, nonsense again, but Watford were really good. Sorry, the other thing was that if you haven't seen the highlights yet from the Southampton-Leicester game, it's brilliant.
Unbelievable game,
like,
yeah.
It's absolutely sensational. It's like a 4.5-minute package on YouTube. You should check out like the quality of the goals that are being scored, and also you get to see Schmeichel giving out to the ball. He's screaming angrily at the ball for going in. It's one of the most Kasper Schmeichel moments you're ever going to see. But the point about Chelsea that I think that is beginning to convince me a bit more is that I thought they'd be dropping points in games like this, where they actually didn't have enough cut and thrust to break down teams who were doing well against them. And actually, it turns out they're very efficient when they don't have your boy Timo Werner in the team. Take him out of the team and things are good. Not in the team at the weekend, things not so good. Sorry, in the team at the weekend, things not so good. Out of the team last night, a bit better.
It was a bad take, the Werner take.
Don't worry, I'll let you forget it in around about 2024. I think, like, can you work Lukaku back into the team? And is it a natural fit? I'm not sure. It's not a natural fit the way I think Erling Haaland instead of Gabriel Jesus will turn Manchester City into the greatest team of all time.
Is that not a problem, though? Is that, like, if you can't fit Lukaku or Werner into the team, maybe not Werner, but Lukaku into the team, is that not a problem for Chelsea?
I don't know. Like, do they need him?
Possibly. Like, I do think last night was different to, say, the Burnley game or the Manchester United game, when Chelsea are uber dominant. And I would agree with what Tuchel said after both games. This thing just happens in football, and sometimes weird things happen. Like, Watford had 14 shots last night, Chelsea had 8. I know Chelsea had maybe a tiny bit more possession, but they were like, this thing could have gone differently, and I really do think that without Lukaku on the pitch, well, now in fairness, Lukaku was on the pitch. He played 20 minutes. He didn't get a single shot. I just feel that there's still something missing from that attack. Now, the chances are they will explode and they will do another 7-0 win against a bottom half team at some point soon. But I think that if you're like me, picked Chelsea to win the Premier League at the start of the season, you there is still enough to be concerned about over the last couple of weeks. But again, it just plays into this idea that it's going to be a really exciting few months, and like we'll start to know, we'll know in a month or a month and a half exactly how real this expectation is going to be. But there's enough there about Chelsea and about Manchester City. There's enough flaws there to give us hope that there's going to be a proper three-horse race. But
Liverpool's form is sensational at the moment. They're blowing teams away. They're blowing every type of team away. So, like, maybe they just assert their dominance over the next 4 weeks and have a 5-point lead and never relinquish it. That's a strong possibility at the moment.
But the depth is the issue on Liverpool's front. Like, City went on that run last year and De Bruyne was injured.
Yeah.
That's the complete difference.
No, it's fair. And also, City were sensational last night, apart from the fact that they did concede a couple of chances. That was the last thing. Ederson is the best goalkeeper in the world by a mile. Like, Alisson's very good, but Ederson is just ridiculous.
Right.
Like, Bazuna watching his tape week in, week out is very good for us. But it's going to be a long time before he displaces him as the number one at Man City. He was absolutely unbelievable. Distribution, like 80 yards to straight feet. And I don't know, that's and on top of the shot stopping and the positioning. Like the goal that was scored against him last night bends in, just about clips the inside of the bar and squirts past him. Otherwise he would have saved it.
Yeah.
And everything else he saved.
It needs to be perfect to beat him.
Yeah, exactly. So he is good. And so maybe I've changed my mind. Maybe it's Man City's league. 7:51 this morning. Here's what's coming up between now and 10 o'clock. Andrew Mangan of Arseblog is going to join us at 10 past 8. Sports pages for you with John Duggan at 8:30, where we're going to talk about Rory McIlroy, his ripped shirt, and how he thinks he's Man United. Ron Nogara at 8:40. Going to talk to us about the rugby world, the conundrum at 10 for Ireland and Leinster, sports news at 9 o'clock, Harriet Pryor of the Anfield Wrap at 10 past 9, and then at 9:30, Matt Slater talking to Joe. It is, 7:52 this morning. Again, if you want to get in touch, 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number, and you can get us on that, or you can leave comments for us on the YouTube stream. Brian Dillon says, I don't support Liverpool. In fact, I loathe them, but Salah can ask for all the money in the world and they should give it to him. Generational talent and should become one of the Liverpool greats. I think he's already one of the Liverpool greats. They're going to talk about him ahead of Suarez, ahead of Torres, and he's getting into the conversation with Robbie Fowler, and he's getting into the conversation with Ian Rush. And if he stays, if he signs that new deal, he's in the conversation with Kenny Dalglish.
Yeah.
They need to win one more European Cup, and then it's like him and Dalglish.
Sorry to bring this back to Ballon d'Or, but when I said, you know, the Ballon d'Or next year won't be judged on any major tournament because the World Cup is so late, well, of course, it's different from Salah. I'd be playing in the AFCON in January, so I should correct that. I mean, that could genuinely, as much as it should be judged on everything else, him at least getting to the business end or getting to a final or winning it definitely with Egypt would be like, okay, that's his candidacy confirmed.
Oh, rubber stamped, absolutely. And just don't get injured at the moment. That's the most important thing. So many people unhappy with our Cristiano Ronaldo coverage on the conversation that we had with Jonathan Wilson yesterday. The funny thing is Gilroy is so far up the hole of the ultimate pressing king, Mr. Lionel Messi. The idea that Ronaldo can't fit into a team regardless of their style of play is ridiculous.
He's got a point.
Jesus Christ, will OTB at least bring someone on who will point out the benefits of Ronaldo for the sake of balance, if nothing else, says DJ Hannafin. Not the greatest DJ name I've ever heard. Which of the Hannafins was your inspiration for that one, DJ? Or is that actually your name? Sorry. Shane Mulligan says, lads, this obsession with pressing is ridiculous. Yous don't have a clue about football. I mean, we were talking about it because the current crop of managers who are in charge of the biggest clubs in English football all have the same philosophy. That's what's happened. Whether or not you like it, that's what's happened. Not many of the best teams at the moment aren't actually pressing. And that was very noticeable from Man City last night as well. Why do these bloody sports shows keep asking journalists tactical questions about football? Can Ronaldo play in a pressing system? How the F would you know? I suppose that's true. How would they know? They only sit and watch football all day, every day, and think about it and talk to all the best managers and the best coaches and the players and then get all that information and then do nothing with it. It sits on them like a, you know, like an egg on a new Teflon pan that just glides across. Nothing ever seeps in.
Yeah.
There's no osmosis.
Isn't Nick Hornby in Fever Pitch says that journalists know a lot more than fans about football, but in many ways they know a lot less. So you can take your pick what side of...
Well, he's trying to ride both horses there a little bit.
A little bit, I guess. Yeah,
I guess he never considered himself a journalist, did he? He was always a writer and a fan.
He was just a fan, yeah.
Yeah. Bobby Jukes, though, responded, "So because he isn't a football coach, that invalidates his opinion. Anyone can critically assess football match in terms of tactics. It's not hard to understand what pressing is or how to see how two clubs compete against each other. This is true. I really miss looking at the down vote count. The media's anti-Ronaldo agenda is laughable. Clowns," says Chrisser. And Samson Sam says, "I love OTV, one of the very best channels for Manchester United coverage, but their agenda against Ronaldo is pathetic and sounds personal or editorial. I really hope it's not, because they want to just stir up fans to get more clicks and views, as it's beginning to affect our journalistic integrity to me."
That's the criticism sandwich right there without the bottom piece of bread.
Samson Sam is going to be delighted to read Michael Carrick in the papers today saying he does think Cristiano Ronaldo can press. I didn't say that Cristiano Ronaldo couldn't press. One of my key points yesterday was, wouldn't it have been really interesting to see how he fits into a Guardiola team where he would have been asked to do it? Carrick says he can do it. I mean, he's one of the smartest, hardest working, most driven individuals that the world has ever seen when it comes to football. Do we really think that if he thinks that there's a chance of winning a Champions League with Man United this year, and his job to win that or to be involved is to press, he's not going to do it? How is he going to take the winning penalty? How is he going to take the sixth penalty in a shootout if he's not on the field to do it?
Well, exactly. Like Carrick has said, maybe it's a myth that Ronaldo can't press. Maybe that's how it is. Like, he does make the point, he's played in enough teams over the years and has been successful. He's been able to play a variety of ways and kept scoring goals for every team he's played for, and he'll continue to score goals, no doubt about it. So, like, I mean, that has happened in recent years. He has won a lot of trophies in recent years. So maybe we'll see just a completely different version of it, and maybe the press was so flawed under Solskjaer that the man who is leading the press is always going to be the scapegoat for it. And because he is old, there is this sense that he can get double the blame. Maybe that's what happens here, and maybe this whole thing changes under Ranić over the next little while. But I do think that there is definitely a real school of thought out of there that's gathered momentum, that it's just not going to happen in that way. But he scores a lot of goals.
And the last one, Spotify Wrapped obviously came out yesterday. What was yours like?
Mine was weird, a little bit disappointing. It might I think I must just be listening to Spotify in private quite a lot all year. My stats are very low, 18,000 minutes listened, which is like some of my friends had 100 and something thousand minutes listened. So in the WhatsApp group, I was like, "Yeah, look how into music I am." My number one podcast being like Off the Ball.
That's all right.
Just listening to myself.
That's okay. That's good. That's you know. Rigorous self-analysis. I mean, I'm sure our viewers are like, "I don't believe you," but go on.
Yeah, no, it's just I'm just really pathetic, disappointing. And
who were the artists?
My artists were I can't even remember. My number one song was by a DJ called Octo Octa, and I listened to the song 10 times over the course of the year. So not even once a month,
right?
So there must be something wrong here. I think I listened to that song a lot when I was running earlier in the year.
How do you?
And I stopped running. I don't even know how you
put the private thing on.
You go into your settings and. And basically it's like private session. It's really important for certain Spotify activities, Ger.
Well, like?
Well, like, I mean, there's a lot of people like...
Is there porn on private? What? is there porn on Spotify?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I would assume there is. There's a lot of people who come on Spotify Wrapped and they're like, "Oh, my kids ruin my Spotify Wrapped."
Well, that's...
Again.
Jordan,
I'm like, just put it on private session. If you're not concerned about your Spotify...
I'm not. Wrapped, I'm just...
Put it on private session.
It's just... It's not a point of conversation. It's like... I can't even remember now, but it was definitely not stuff that I was like, I don't know this song.
The thing they did this year was they gave you like your mood from Spotify.
Yeah.
So everybody got these things and I'm not sure what yours was. My moods were innovative and happy, which is just clearly wrong. I did not feel happy in 2021, but Spotify seems to think I did. And my number one artist was Tyler, the Creator, who I listened to a good bit of, but I just didn't really think that I listened to enough of him to be anywhere near the top five. So Spotify Wrapped is always a strange day of self-analysis.
I had Eye of the Tiger was like...
I was like is this something like you listen to on the way into work to bump yourself up?
If your movie was a soundtrack, the opening credits theme would be Eye of the Tiger.
Oh, like, sorry, I see.
No, that one.
Okay.
I'm not listening to Eye of the Tiger a lot, but it's on in our house a lot. And it's because there's a female artist who says, "I've got the Eye of the Tiger," but isn't. And so the kids ask for Eye of the Tiger and they get the other one. And then they're like, "Oh, we really like this one too." So who's that?
I don't know. The other Eye of the Tiger. I actually don't know.
Fight Song? Who is it, Emma? Who is it? Katy Perry.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, that's
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah.
That's like,
you're trying to be cool about Katy Perry.
I know that, but like that's
throwing shade at me. When okay, go for it. I'm here for your Katy Perry shade.
Like, I mean, by all means, good tune. But it's like, why are your kids listening to music from like 2014, 2015?
Like, I mean, I have no idea. I'd say there was a thing called Star Camp where they all go and they learn how to do a little bit of song and dance. And I'd say that they were using. That's where it came from.
So that's your number one song of the year.
Is that Fight Song? No, that's different. So Fight Song is the song that you... The song playing as you defeat the ancient vengeful spirit is Fight Song by Rachel Platten.
I've never heard of that in my life and I can stand over that. I have absolutely no idea what that song is. So this is another one of your...
I also don't know it.
Yeah. So your Spotify has essentially been overtaken. Like, was there any of your own podcasts that appeared in
I use the OTB Sports app for my Off The Ball podcast on, of course
as we all do.
So we're
going to get a copyright.
I'll talk over it now. Obviously I'll just fast forward a little bit. Can I scroll through it? That one,
I've never heard that song in my entire life.
Okay, well that's enough of that then. It's 8:01 this morning here on OTBM. If you want to get in touch with us, Fergal Fitz says 1,351 minutes listening to mostly At Malloy Joe and OTB Rugby across 52 episodes. Oh, McGrath says sheesh, is 160 episodes of OTB Rugby, all of them for the year at Off The Ball. I blame Melbourne's longest lockdown in the world, by the way. Don't blame it, lean into it. That's one of our most prized podcast streams, along with our football and our GAA and our highlights. You should subscribe to all of them. I raise you to 4,934 minutes, says Ian Kenny. 200 episodes of OTB Rugby. It's been a long year. And Matthew Reardon says, add Off The Ball Overload in my top Spotify playlist of the year. OTB GAA number 1, OTB Rugby number 2, Football Pod Paddy 90 number 3, OTB Football number 4, and OTB's Crappy Quiz number 5. Keep up the good work at Off The Ball. At Jerry Gilroy, 260 episodes, 5,686 minutes of OTV football. That is a lot.
I'm surprised we're still uploading the Crappy Quiz to its own podcast sphere, to be honest. That was a big takeaway for me there. That's really good news, and it's broken somebody's top five.
Right, OTV AM brought to you by Gillette, and turns out this morning Spotify. Good morning, start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. You can actually listen without any humiliation on the OTV Sports app. We don't keep a tally, a running tally, you know. And you shouldn't be humiliated. You just like something. It's okay to like things. That's how the world has gone. You can be yourself more these days.
Feels pointed.
You feel seen, Owen.
Yeah, I feel seen. Very, very seen. I'm not judging your Spotify rap. I think it was very impressive.
Right. Tanisha Sullivan ran the show for the Republic of Ireland against Georgia on Tuesday night in our record 11-0 win. Scored her first ever hat-trick and caught up with Nathan in Tala after the game.
Well, Denise, congratulations. I'd say you enjoyed that.
I definitely did, and thank you. Great performance. First career hat-trick, so I was very happy
with that. First career hat-trick?
Yeah, it is. Surprised myself a bit, to be honest, but the most important thing tonight, I think, was the team performance, and the professional approach that the team went in with was very important, so very happy with the win.
And you really did lead from the front. Even from the first couple of minutes, I got the sense that you were at it tonight, that you sort of knew you had to impose yourself on the game right from the start.
Yeah, I did. After the other night, I think a bit disappointed in the performance, and I think we all were. So I think it was with that mentality tonight to get going from the beginning, and that was my mentality as well. And I think we all done that, and I think to score early was very important and getting the front foot. So yeah, it's a great night.
What have the last few days been like? Because initially afterwards people were trying to talk positively, it was a tough game against Slovakia, but I guess after that hard fought win in Finland there was an expectation of 6 points. How's it been in camp for the last few days?
Yeah, it's been good. I think right after the game we were disappointed, obviously, against Slovakia. I think that shows how far this team has come, that we were disappointed to get a point from a good team, actually. But then you just have to forget about it. We had to, you know, think positive and just focus on this game. And I think that's what we done. As we showed tonight, we came out and scored a lot of goals.
Kind of thought tonight it might be one of those where it's 2-3-0 after an hour and we do that Irish thing of sort of shutting up shop and being happy with the 3 points and all that. Vera was saying that part of the game plan was actually just that relentlessness of keep going, chances, mm-hmm. goals.
Yeah, it was. And I think going into the game we wanted to be rootless, and I think that's what we done tonight. Once we scored the first last couple, I think a few of us were just kept saying, we got to keep going, we got to keep banging in the goals. So it was very important to see that tonight from us. And yeah, I'm proud of the team, the way everyone played. I think the players that came onto the pitch were absolutely fantastic. They didn't leave the intensity drop as well. So it's important to recognise those players as well, and the work that they do in and around the training pitch, they make us better. So yeah, it was a great team performance.
I don't know how much you can read into a game like that where you play pretty much the entire game inside their 45, but in terms of your position and role, how different was it, say, from last Thursday?
Yeah, I didn't get on the ball a lot last Thursday, so I think tonight it was about just moving the ball quickly. I think the girls done a great job of that in the back line, just shifting the ball across and not rushing things like we did. I don't think we had any control over the game last Thursday, and I think that was the big difference. We set tempo tonight. We went in the right moments, picked and choose what moments we should go in. So it was just important for me to get in. The staff were saying it before this game, just get in between the lines, stay there and be patient and the ball will come to you. And yeah, I did. First few minutes, didn't get many touches tonight, but after that I just stayed patient. You know, you kind of have to stand around a bit and just be unselfish, really, and just sit in those pockets, and the ball came to me, so I was happy.
Oh, it was nice we can be unselfish and still get a hat-trick.
Yeah, I guess so. Happy with the hat-trick for sure, but 3 points was the most important thing, so yeah. I'm very happy.
There's some friendlies coming up probably in February against some tough opposition, but in terms of you trying to get on the ball more and what you learned from tonight for, say, the Sweden away and the disappointment of not being able to have the impact on Thursday,
right?
What do you learn from Thursday to make sure that you do have the influence that I think at this stage almost everyone expects you to have?
Yeah, I think it's about controlling the game, honestly. In that midfield, I didn't think we'd done that the other night, and I didn't do that, so I think
why?
I mean,
I'm sure there's no easy answer, but
there's not no easy answer. No, I just think it's about controlling the game, and I think tonight we done that. I think the sitting midfielders had a lot of space to do that, so the other night we didn't. They were on us, they were physical, and we didn't react well enough to that, I don't think. So I think it's just about that confidence, getting on the ball, knowing that we can play, just having those, you know, bringing your players into the game. So yeah, we just kick on from here. It was a really good performance. So
midway point of the campaign, second spot, it's where you want to be at the end of this campaign. Make sure you get that playoff. How do you reflect on the year then, and the hopes for next year?
Yeah, it's been a good year so far. I think this team is climbing and climbing, and we're going upwards, so that's good. But I still think we've a long way to go. We've got tough games coming up next year. Sweden, Finland, we got the win away to Finland, but it was a really tough game, and they're going to be a hard team to play against when they come here as well. So we got to keep our feet firmly on the ground and keep working hard. And I'm excited.
And you're one of the lucky ones. A lot of your teammates are going back to England. They got to play at the weekend. You can go and party now with the match ball back in Cork for Christmas. You'll
honestly
be parading it around.
No partying for me. I'll be straight into the gym when I get back. So a few days off, a few days just to settle down and rest the body, and then back at it again.
Well, go enjoy it. Well done tonight. Congrats.
Cheers.
It's Denise O'Sullivan after her hat-trick at Tallaght the other night for the Republic of Ireland in their 11-0 win. It's a big week for her, obviously. A big week for Katie McCabe, because there's an FA Cup final to look forward to at the weekend. It's last season's FA Cup final that was held back because of COVID. It's Arsenal against Chelsea. It's on Sunday and it's on the BBC. It's a big night for Arsenal. It's a big week for Arsenal and the men's and women's teams. It's a big night tonight because they're up against Manchester United. We're going to talk to Andrew Mangan of Arsblog next.
OTB
AM. All right, it's 8:10 and we're turning our attention to Arsenal. I'm glad to say Andrew Mangan of Arsblog is with us this morning. Andrew, good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
Yeah, good. I'm looking forward to this game tonight. We were talking about this a little bit earlier on. Owen is one of those Arsenal fans who is a glass half empty man at the moment. Are you a glass half full man yourself?
I'm not sure where my glass is at the moment. It's sometimes half full, sometimes a bit half empty, but I think it's edging towards the glass half full side of things, because over the last couple of months, Arsenal have been, they've been pretty solid. There have been some encouraging signs in terms of how the team is playing, how it's been put together. A lot of changes, obviously, to the personnel. There's a freshness about the team and the players, and that's really pleasing rather than seeing kind of the same old mistakes again and again. So, I'm edging towards half full, but obviously tonight is a big challenge for Arsenal.
I think it's really just Arsenal PTSD more than anything else, Andrew, that speaks to the glass half empty view, the fact that something is going to bite them in the ass eventually. Now, of course, the trends are good, the results are good, the age profile is good, both managerially and on the pitch, so you can't really make a case against them going in the right direction. Just the slight concern I'd have is, say, the Palace game, the Brighton game, the Leicester game. It kind of felt in those three games in particular that Arsenal got a better result than they perhaps deserved on the day, and even before the Newcastle game at the weekend, I think they were 15th in the table if you go with non-penalty expected goals. So it's that lack of threat, I think, in attack, and maybe getting goals, more goals than they potentially deserve out of games, is what's maybe giving me a little bit of concern.
Yeah, that's understandable. I take issue with the Leicester game because I think Arsenal absolutely deserved to win that on the day. Crystal Palace and Brighton, difficult games, and probably games on paper that you would expect Arsenal to win, or certainly the Arsenal of old to win. I'm a little bit torn on this because it's a concern of mine as well, the lack of goals. I think Arsenal have a negative goal difference, slightly skewed by some big defeats against Liverpool and Manchester City. But my major worry, I suppose, about Mikel Arteta and the kind of football that he plays and he's trying to get his team to play is chance creation and goal scoring, and I think we're a bit light in that regard. There aren't enough goals, there aren't enough players who score goals. At the same time, though, you can look at the statistics, but then you look at the table and you look at the number of points that Arsenal have had, and if they can win games 1-0 and 2-0, maybe they don't need to score a lot of goals. I do think it's an area where you will get found out, though, where the volume of chances that you create will come back to bite you if you, you know, if you let a couple in. I think Arsenal have been pretty defensively solid, which is part of why we are where we are right now. But there are going to be games when things don't go as well as they should in that regard as well. So then you're going to need to score the goal. So I know what you're saying about that, and it is a concern. But, you know, if they can keep scrapping out the wins, if you like, and I think a couple of the wins have been pretty scrappy, it's points on the board that really matters the most.
I think the PTSD point is important here because I suspect the players have had a little bit of that, and it looked clear to me in the Liverpool game in particular where they started brightly, but once the goals were conceded, the heads dropped, and that's not a team who's high on confidence or who feels they can recover from that, because they don't have that credit in the bank just yet. But the fact that they're winning tight games against relatively similar standard opposition, that would give me some sense that, like, they have some confidence. It's building slowly, and, you know, success is lumpy, and it's going to come in bits and pieces here for Arsenal. I would feel more positive as an outsider watching what's going on now than at any point during the Arteta period, that there's a definitive style of play. He chops and changes the team, but it always seems to make sense when he does. He's getting better performances from players over a period of time than they were previously. That suggests good coaching and an overarching structure where they're trying to do something again and again and again. And as a football fan, that's kind of all I want.
Yeah, I like that. Success is lumpy. That's a really good way of putting it. The point about Liverpool, you know, a lot of the players haven't really experienced Anfield before. You know, so maybe the PTSD that you reference would certainly have been more applicable to Arsenal sides of the past. And there was obviously a familiarity about the way the game went against Liverpool and the scoreline in particular. But in the first half, I thought Arsenal were quite brave in terms of how they tried to play it out from the back. We know how good Liverpool are, how high they press, and how quickly they can hurt you if you lose the ball in your half. So there were encouraging signs there. But the fact is, this is a really young team. It's been put together pretty much over the course of this last summer's transfer window. There were six signings. Most of them are in the team on a regular basis now. There's young players like Bukayo Saka and Emile Smith Rowe who have come through the academy. And the experienced players, the likes of Lacazette, the likes of Aubameyang, Thomas Partey, I think they're the ones who maybe need to step up a little bit now and show a bit of guidance, a bit of leadership, a bit of been there, done that kind of savvy, particularly for games like this, because Manchester United have not been brilliant this season by any stretch of the imagination. but they have such an array of attacking talent, such depth in those positions that going there is going to be very difficult. I don't think Arsenal will go there with any fear, but United are a team that can hurt you and will hurt you and will keep going right until the end. We've seen them score lots of late goals this season so far. So on a night like tonight, you're looking for those senior players maybe just to step up and do a bit more and guide these young players who I think are going to go out and try and do what they do in every game, regardless of where it is and who they're playing against.
That transfer window that you speak about, there was obviously a very slow start to the season for Arsenal, and part of that's the natural bedding in period. Part of that was probably them not quite sure exactly what they'd got in terms of how they were all going to fit into the overarching plan. But that would suggest that the club is more unified than perhaps we were led to believe in the summer, because it seemed like from the exterior that there was a power struggle, but maybe that's not the case.
I'm not sure there was necessarily a power struggle. I mean, there was previously when Wenger left and there was this triumvirate of Gazidis and Raul Sanyehi, Sven Mislintat, there was certainly a power struggle there, and the man who came out on top was, he left the previous summer. I think there's probably more unity behind the scenes than people realised. There was a quote from Arteta after the opening three games, and Arsenal lost all three games. They lost to Brentford, to Man City and Chelsea, and clearly that has an impact on how you're viewed as a manager, fan opinion and all of that kind of stuff. And he came out and he said something along the lines of, this is the best 10 or 15 days of my football career. You know, this is a man who's won trophies. Excuse me. You know, he's had some success as a player. So it sounded like a really strange thing to say. But what I think happened behind the scenes was he had the backing of his players. He didn't lose his players after those three games. And that was really important. I think that's been the bedrock of this recent run, this uptick in form. Players who have gone out and worked really hard. You know, some of the wins, excuse me again, were really scrappy. Norwich and Burnley, for example, the two games immediately after that first international break, 2-1-0 wins. Tough going, but you don't get those wins unless the players are behind you. So there's certainly a unity between the players and the manager and the executive team. They backed him, they have faith in him, and so far they've been rewarded with that for the most part, because look, there have been some ups and downs, and there will be ups and downs when you've got a young team that's inexperienced. But the table, I think, tells its own story. If you'd said to Arsenal fans after those opening three games of the season, you could go into the top four at the start of December with a win, I'm not sure many would have believed it, but that's the case.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Like, when you look at the thing you just spoke about there about Arteta and the trust the players have in him, that's the thing that would give you real hope to actually be able to build on something this season. That if, say, the top four challenge does fade away over a period of time, that there is a manager here who the players are fully backing. And if there are any concerns that this young squad could get picked off by their rivals over the course of the next few transfer windows, the fact that those players are in full belief of their manager probably allays those fears a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think as a player, if you can see that you're in a team and at a club that is, in inverted commas, going places or has the potential to, you know, to challenge for things, I mean, that's where Arsenal need to get back to. You know, they need to get back into Europe. They need to get back into the Champions League. They need ultimately to become a team that can challenge for the title. And that's a long way away. When you look at the three teams who are going to go for it this season, Chelsea, Liverpool and Manchester City, leaving aside the resources that they have. And I say this because, you know, after Arsenal spent more money than anybody in the transfer window last summer. So it's not simply a question of resources and money, but how mature those teams are, how much they've grown together and developed over time and changed. And, you know, that's a tough level to get to, particularly when there are other clubs who are going to try and do it. You know, Manchester United have brought in Ralf Rangnick, who's a very smart appointment in the short term. And ultimately, they're going to have to go for something in the long term as well. So there was really only one way for Arsenal to do this, to try and get back there, and that was to grow something together. They tried the being there, done that, worn the T-shirt players, you know, the likes of David Luiz and Willian, who they thought could come in and whose experience could, you know, bridge the gap. And we saw that it couldn't. And, you know, those players are gone, and I'm glad they're gone. And there's no assurances when you do it like this, when you do it with young players. But at least there is a strategy. At least somebody has sat down and said, look, the way we were doing it, we were going nowhere. We have to do it differently. We have to try something else. The age profile of the players that they brought in, all either 22, 23 or 24 years of age, or maybe 21, 22, 23, something like that. They've got young players in there like Smith Rowe, Saka, Martinelli, who I mentioned, Gabriel, the central defender as well, is still very young. You know, this is a really, really young team. There are going to be ups and downs. There are going to be blips along the way, but it really does represent Arsenal's best chance to grow something and to develop a side that can hopefully compete. And I think if you get back into Europe, if you generate more revenue, if you've got that profile again, then maybe next summer or the summer after, you can add that little bit of star quality in the transfer market, if you like, you know, because you're an attractive destination again for the top players. Top players aren't going to come to a club that isn't in Europe, that isn't in the Champions League. And that's a reality that Arsenal have had to deal with. It doesn't mean that they won't go for those kind of signings in the future, but they have to build to a point where those kind of players want to come.
Yeah, and you get them at the right stage of their career. Like, you know, the comparisons with Liverpool, I think, are always worth making, because that first season when Klopp arrived wasn't a success for them, although they ended up in a cup final and they lost that cup final. There was like a long, slow, steady build. People think, oh, Jurgen Klopp arrived and immediately they got jolted into a world-class side. They actually, they had to make sure that the squad was the right age profile and ready to do the things that he wanted them to do on the field, and then they added in the world class players as well. Can I ask about Aubameyang, because I think one of the key things from what's happened is that there's no longer a circus. It feels like there's no longer a circus around Arsenal, that stuff isn't leaking out, that there isn't a constant drip feed of stuff undermining the management. Like, if you think back to last season and Aubameyang's car and the revving of the car outside and him being pissed off about being dropped, that was a massive sideshow for your most important player to be involved in. And yet here he is back contributing. Like, it's very difficult to come back from a scenario where the agent is clearly, or somebody close to, is telling bad things to the press and the press are lapping it up because it's the soap opera that we all are so addicted to. That to me suggests a very mature management style, where you have a massive asset, and instead of just burning it out, you rekindle that relationship somehow, and you don't lose face with the rest of your team. Difficult job.
Yeah, I mean, I do think the Aubameyang thing was slightly overblown. You know, that incident where he turned up late for the North London Derby and was dropped because of that. I mean, it's part of the way Arteta has dealt with certain things, that he has these non-negotiables, as he calls them. And like, if you're captain or if you're the 19-year-old, the rules apply to everybody in the same way. And Aubameyang's, you know, Arsenal had a difficult season last season. They finished eighth. It wasn't good enough. They had that terrible run. Aubameyang didn't score enough goals. And clearly, as like a world-class striker who has scored 25, 30 goals every season for the last 6-7 years, when there's a drop-off like that, people immediately looked at it like the Ozil situation. You got the contract, and now the productivity has dwindled. There were a lot of off-field things with Aubameyang. You know, he did have a sick relative that played a part. He also got malaria. He had a couple of injuries. For me, it was never really a case that, you know, he was phoning it in or he didn't care or anything like that. I just think there were reasons why he had a bad season. He's having a, you know, there are a lot of questions about him now over the last couple of weeks because he hasn't scored since the Villa game in October and everything else. But he missed a penalty against Watford. He missed a glorious chance against Newcastle at the weekend, which, you know, 99 times out of 100, he sticks that away. And we're not necessarily having that conversation. But, you know, Arteta has to find some balance in the squad. You can't do it all with young players. So he does need Aubameyang. He does need Partey. He does need Lacazette. These guys around the first team who, you know, can provide that guidance. Aubameyang maybe is an easy target, but I still think the goals or Arsenal's best... he's our best striker, basically. There's an issue down the line, certainly, where Arsenal have to address that position in the transfer market. I think they'll do it next summer. But for now, he's the main man. He gets picked in every game. I think he'll start tonight. And, you know, hopefully he can get back on the goal-scoring track.
Is Martinelli a ready-made successor to Aubameyang if he does start to go on the downturn with age?
I don't know, really. It's hard to know exactly what Gabriel Martinelli is. Is he a centre-forward? Is he a wide player? I'm not quite sure on that yet, but certainly he's got fantastic goal-scoring instincts, as we saw against Newcastle. That was a brilliant goal. And in his first season at Arsenal, you know, I think he scored 10 goals as an 18-year-old. So he's got that potential. It's just quite where he will fit into the team. I'm not sure yet. It could be centre-forward. It could be wide. He is a bit like Aubameyang in that he's not really a guy who gets a lot of touches. He's not that involved in the build-up. He wants to be on the end of things, as his movement for that goal against Newcastle showed. But certainly there's a player of real potential and promise there. It's just quite where they see him. We're not sure because he hasn't played a great deal this season. There are other options as well. Follerin Balogun is a very talented young striker who's way too good for the under-23 level now. Whether he's quite ready to step up when Aubameyang goes to the African Cup of Nations, I'm not quite sure. He could need a loan, but they do have some young players there who could challenge for sure.
It seems like it's actually quite exciting if you can both allow yourselves to be excited as Arsenal fans. Owen still refusing to point blank to allow himself to get carried away. But when you start listing off the talent and the age profile, like when you were talking about the squad, just checking, Martinelli's still only 20, has recovered from a big injury, has had that 10 goals in a season. Like if he only ever scores 10 goals every season between now and the end of his career at Arsenal, that's a great career for a forward. There is something building there.
There is. I mean, the ingredients are there. We have to see if they can be all cooked together to make a delicious meal in the end. But certainly, it's easy to get behind young players as well, because you first and foremost, you look for their potential. You say, what could they be? And you perhaps project onto them all the possibilities that they could achieve in the game. But there's also the fact that they haven't disappointed you. They haven't annoyed you. You know, we're not talking about the likes of Luiz, like Mustafi, Kolasinac, players who've been there and done that and didn't do it and did the same terrible things time and time again, which becomes infuriating and hard to live with and hard to deal with. You know, they made 6 signings this summer, and if all 6 of those signings are fixtures in the team in 3 or 4 years, we can say that's an incredible piece of transfer business. It may not be. I think maybe 1 or 2 of them won't quite reach the heights and may depart along the way. But for now, you're looking at these guys who are coming in. They're young. They've got a point to prove. They're hungry. And it's exciting. It's just far preferable to what we've had at Arsenal over the last number of years, that this strategy, it feels coherent.
Yeah.
And the potential of it is obviously high. Whether we get there or not, we'll have to wait and see. But it's much nicer to be sitting here thinking about what it could be than what you don't want it to be in the present, if that makes sense.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's the absence of randomness now is something that you can believe in and have faith in. And this is worthy of the time that you spend on whatever team you support is, as opposed to just being badly managed. 2 quick things I wanted to mention. The Women's Cup final is on Sunday against Chelsea. Katie McCabe starring for Arsenal at the moment. I talked to her recently for our Cadbury's Roadshow, and she was saying that there's not much crossover, but there is definitely some crossover. They kind of say at various stages she'll go and watch the men's team train, and there does seem to be a proper concerted effort from the club to put out a united front and to unify the support base.
Well, you know, when we were looking at what Arsenal were going to do at executive level this summer, one of the interesting things was they had to replace Joe Montemurro, who is the previous manager. Really popular guy, successful. And what were the club going to do when we were looking for them to invest in the men's team? Were there signs that the decision making at executive level, when they came to addressing some of the issues on the women's team, could that give us a clue as to like their efficacy, how good they were? And they brought in a very good manager. He's had an incredible start. Jonas Eideval has had a great start. They brought in some really good players, high profile players, Tobin Heath, for example. They've built a squad which is now bigger and more robust. He can go into certain games and rest the likes of Vivian Miedema, who is clearly one of the best strikers in the world. So there is definitely progression there when it comes to the Arsenal women's team. They're having a great season. They've got the final on Sunday. And there is more, I think, awareness. There's more interest across the Arsenal fan base in the women's team now, which is great to see. They're going to play against Barcelona at the Emirates next week in the Champions League, and there's going to be a lot of people there to see that. So hopefully it goes well on Sunday. Katie McCabe, obviously a hugely talented player, has been brilliant for Arsenal and for Ireland this season. And if she came up with the goods at Wembley on Sunday, you wouldn't be at all surprised.
No, of course not. And speaking of coming up with the goods, congratulations to you. Second year in a row, you've won the Fan Media of the Year at the FSA Awards. This is a big deal. People in Ireland might not be familiar with it, but like, these are the main football writers' awards. The Football Journalist of the Year, we had him on yesterday. Jonathan Wilson was crowned. He was pretty happy about life. You must be pretty happy about this because you've done back to back.
Yeah, defended our titles, so we're very pleased. And you know, we've spent a lot of time. I talked about the women's team. We've really enhanced our coverage of the women's team. We've got a brilliant correspondent, Tim Stillman, who is basically the main man when it comes to the Arsenal women's team in terms of coverage and his knowledge of it. And we're doing more video stuff, so we're trying to expand as much as we can. All the stuff around the men's team, the youth teams. It's a growing team of people at Arsblog right now. It's not just me. There are, you know, seven or eight regular contributors and specializing in different things, tactics and stats and all of that kind of stuff. So the award was, you know, an acknowledgement of all the work that they've done over the last year as well. So we'll keep going and keep trying, and maybe we can make it three in a row next year.
Well, listen, well deserved. You were one of the pioneers of fan media back for the last 2.5 decades. So an overnight success with back-to-back awards, but it's been 20 years in the making, Andrew. Congratulations.
Thanks, Ger. Really appreciate it.
That's Andrew Mangan there of Arsblog, who knows the ins and outs of that club better than almost anybody in the world at this point. Surely now you're like, yeah, come on.
Yeah, it's hard. It's like, I mean, Arsenal going into a game against Manchester United as favourites. I mean, what could possibly go wrong? I actually don't know for sure, but it feels that there's certainly there's a bit of momentum going into a massive game. But look, it's you've described me as a glass half empty fan, and it's impossible to look at it in a glass half full way sometimes when you're following Arsenal. But this year has been hopeful, and as I said, I don't deny that they're going in the right direction. It's just this immediate form that they're in at the moment. I'm just questioning the veracity of that at the moment.
Fool me once, shame on you. Ain't gonna fool me second, third time. That's you. You're George W. Bush, right?
I really am, but it's like I'm about to be fooled for the 746th time.
Oh no, the glorious sport of you feel alive. You commit to this, the new iteration, and then they break your heart again, and you're like, never again, and then they suck you back in. That's what this is about, Owen.
Yeah.
That's why we do this.
Yes, I know.
To feel alive.
I know. Maybe I'm just yarrowing away everything else, and this is actually deep down, I actually believe that they're going to win everything and conquer all their land in the next couple of years.
Yeah, it's a bad thing, I'm telling you. It's like I'm like Red and Shawshank. Hope is a dangerous thing. Yeah, it's a bad thing. It's the opposite of hope.
It is. It's taking away your happiness.
You talk yourself into it, and you're like, oh, am I sorry, who was I yarring, me or them?
Yeah, but the thing is, it doesn't exist. Obviously, it's just a complete fabrication.
Double media fabrication.
Exactly. Why would you want to absolutely get rid of your sense of happiness?
All right. OTBAM brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. You can have very clearly defined moles like me. Right. Quick newspapers. Here's what's on otbsports.com. These people paid the ultimate price for Qatar's World Cup experiment. That's Matt Slater talking about the sports washing and the World Cup in Qatar. Motherwell Hail Boys starlet, sorry, Hail Bows starlet, not boys, starlet Ross Tierney's unlimited potential. Sean O'Leary, Cork hurling legend, dead at 69. An absolute legend of the game. We'd like to send our condolences to the Cork GAA community and the Munster rugby community and everybody who came across Seanie O'Leary. What a hurler, what a presence. I think in our obituary we mentioned that he'd ended up in Eddie Brennan's top five inside forwards when we got him to do that during lockdown, and rightfully so. The stories that you'll have read in the paper about him breaking his nose in the warm up and Christy Ring saying you don't hurt your nose, and then he goes out and scores 1-2, but they're just a load of games. And then the other thing that I think helped characterise Seanie O'Leary was Micheál O'Hare's commentary. Just whenever you would hear on the telly, on the old highlights, whenever a sports stadium had nothing on or a match got postponed, they'd stick out an old tape of Cork, always Cork winning. Mm. And the ball would go to Seanie O'Leary, and Micheál O'Hare's, the way he would describe it, there would be a pause, he'd go Seanie O'Leary, and then it would be goal. Mm. That was just like, and in his inimitable tones. Unfortunately, he's passed away very young at 69, and we want to send our condolences to the entire family and the Cork GAA community as well. So, okay. It's 8:37. Quick newspaper back pages. We're going to talk about Rory McIlroy with John Duggan a little bit later. There's a picture of Johan van Graan, so he doesn't have COVID. So there's a process of elimination underway at this stage. He's going to be quarantining on his own for the next 10 days, and hopefully ready to take the team to Wasps, to Ricoh Arena in Coventry. Testing times for Munster's Champions Cup chaos looms. Clancy to assume St. Pat's reigns. This is the story that Stephen O'Donnell is going to get the Dundalk manager and get the Dundalk job. There does seem to be a bit of a dispute at the moment, which is unfortunate, between Dundalk and St. Pat's about contract and potential for compensation. So we'll see. Tim Clancy is going to take charge at Richmond Park. McIlroy sees red over questions about ripping up shirts. And then Demolition Derby is the headline in the back of the Guardian. Salah leads Liverpool rout of sorry Everton. The Briony Frost story we'll get into a little bit later on. Frost, no one dares back me. Tearful jockey says female riders cannot speak out. Dunn opened towel and shook himself. Frost tells BHA panel Dunn exposed himself to her. Briony Frost, Britain's most successful female jump jockey, says The Guardian, told a disciplinary panel yesterday her fellow rider Robbie Dunn subjected her to deliberate verbal and physical abuse, which included an incident in which he opened his towel and shook himself in front of her and came to a head after a race at Southall in September 2020. We'll get into that in more detail a little bit later on. The Herald, Dub legend McManaman, the big player for the big occasions. Are all these retirements giving Kerry people a bit of hope? The various slayers of Kerry over the years are now one by one shuffling off.
I understand why you're framing the question in that way, but like, why not focus on the hope that it will give the top two teams in the country, aka Tyrone and Mayo, the teams who contested the All-Ireland final last year? Can they increase
have a Tyrone or Mayo person in studio at the moment.
Can they increase their gap over the Dubs next year is the way you should be phrasing that question, because that's all important, isn't it?
Kevin McManaman slayed you on a couple of separate occasions. I'd say there's PTSD for Kerry people, it's actually
that's Kevin Mack. Yeah,
one of them. Kevin McManaman's hands. You're like,
that's
no,
not even.
No, it wasn't. Like Brogan and Connolly and Flynn, and they were all great.
They were all dead by a thousand cuts.
Yeah,
but
Kevin Mack was
the two.
Bleeding out.
It's like if
you can see the pool of blood getting bigger and bigger. You're like, is that me? Yes, it is.
Did they do that shocking dramatic technique in Game of Thrones twice when the mountain crushes the skull? Or was it just the once? They didn't bother doing it a second time because it would be just too false and too fake. Well, Kevin McManaman crushed the skull twice. It was bad enough once, but the eyeballs got pushed into the skull to the point of explosion twice.
I think they do, don't they? They do
in
twice.
The relationship between Kerry and Dublin recently, and Kevin McManaman was the person who exacted it on both occasions.
Better than Game of Thrones is what you're saying, Kevin Mack.
You're right, exactly. Better or worse than Game of Thrones, depending on your point of view, I guess.
Yeah.
Or more grotesque. It's some career. And I think the dominant theme across all the pieces written this morning is don't call him an impact sub, because I think he is the epitome of modern Gaelic games as opposed to an impact sub. He was absolutely vital to Dublin, and I'm sure that they missed him when he was away for a large swathe of this summer as well, or last summer.
And the front page of the Examiner is a beautiful picture of Seanie O'Leary. Farewell, Seanie. Cork mourns four-time All-Ireland hero O'Leary. and they've got his red jersey and him in colour and the rest of it in black and white. So as I said, we send our condolences. It's 8:41 this morning. If you want to get in touch with us, we'd love to hear from you. 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number. News coming through this morning that Larry McCarthy has confirmed the appointment of a task force to analyse the various options identified in the context of the fixture reviews, right? So a new GAA task force will bring proposals to change in the structure for debate at annual Congress in February 2022. So they are striking while the iron is hot. Members are going to include Larry McCarthy himself, Ciara McLaughlin of Tyrone, Ger Ryan of Tipperary, Derek Kent of Wexford, Vincent Neary of Mayo, John Halbert of Cork, Ronan Sheehan from Down/GPA, John Joe Carroll of Kerry, Tomás Oireann, that's Tom Ryan, Director General, and Fergal McGill. So Ronan Sheehan and Fergal McGill were on the last FRC. So Ronan, obviously, from the GPA, he had been in favour of option B. Aidan O'Rourke has just tweeted, he says, as solid as this list of Gaels is, could someone not have had the foresight to include at least one member who has either played, coached or managed inter-county football? After all, the subject matter is the future shape and direction of inter-county football. So that is the crack with that.
I think that's probably a fair point from Aidan O'Rourke. At the same time, it's interesting that it is a big kind of crossover. Or sorry, there is no crossover at all, really, with the exception of Ronan Sheehan and Fergal McGill from the previous task force. So they want to start afresh and bring new blood through when it comes to making these decisions. So I think there's going to be debate at annual Congress in February, which might inform the direction that the task force actually takes it. I presume will lead to either a special Congress next year or annual Congress at the start of 2023, having some sort of vote on what these guys come up with.
Okay, so John Fogarty has this story today in the Examiner. In a circular to Central Council delegates, it was explained the group had been empowered to make recommendations pertaining to the Championship to Central Council with a mind to endorsing them for Congress. So the plan is to strike while the iron is hot. This will end up being Larry McCarthy's legacy. It is the defining and only matter that has the power to completely change the future of the future of Gaelic football. So let's wait and see. The review, taking careful cognizance of the key desired objective of championship reform, has identified a number of broad approaches open to the association and specific proposals which meet these objectives. So let's wait and see exactly what happens. But so all four provincial councils are represented, which means that we're guaranteed to have the option. The provincial councils are all going to make sure that the power of the provinces is not diminished. Turkeys aren't going to vote for Christmas, so we're going to have the provinces playing a role in the All-Ireland series.
Yeah. Like it's going to be very, very interesting to see how these debates actually happen and how much information is put out into the public domain about the debates that actually happen in these conversations, because that was one of the themes of the previous conversation and the discourse before the last Congress, was that, oh, there wasn't enough debate about this, or there wasn't enough information out there. And obviously you had people calling for roadshows, and you had people calling for more information, and you had people calling for more debate, even though really there wasn't enough.
We've been talking about it for 20 years. Literally, we've been talking about it for 20 years.
So it'd be interesting to see how it's approached on that front, I think, because that was definitely used as a stick to beat. The last angle with and special Congress of 2021.
It's the vice chairman of the provincial councils who are all going to sit on it, and a current member of the CCC, John Halbert, and the GPA representative Ronan Sheehan, and GAA trustee John Joe Carroll of Kerry. So they're the people who'll be deciding exactly what comes next. Interesting, as Aidan O'Rourke pointed out, no player or inter-county manager involved. So there you go. It is 8:45. OTBAM brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. A couple of quick Chelsea comments. Chelsea's top scorers, Reece James, says Dahio Shoknesig. If Lukaku doesn't start scoring again, that could be a big problem through the season. Werner's useless. Oh, Dahio, just let on. Let his tepid Werner take disappear. It's okay. He doesn't mind. Michael Byrne says, watching this morning from Raleigh, North Carolina, where it's about 2 o'clock in the morning, nearly 3. Chelsea looked very poor last night against Watford. Any ideas of who you'd choose in that midfield pivot if the usual suspects remain out at the weekend?
Realise who would you use in that midfield pivot at the weekend? Jorginho wasn't used last night, was he?
Yeah, he was on the bench though, wasn't he? So obviously not fit enough to I don't know enough about the injury situation and how quickly Conte is going to be back, but we'll see. Ronan O'Gara is going to join us in the next few minutes. In this week's Red 78 podcast, Niamh Briggs was talking about the insight she got to Munster's unique current training situation, with the majority of the team set to miss their upcoming European fixture at Wasps. We'll see. The club's academy players have joined up with the returning internationals to formulate a squad. Here's what she thought of the setup.
You just got to observe their pitch session. It was really interesting to see. So obviously you had the likes of the internationals. So Peter O'Mahony, Conor Murray, Andrew Conway, Keith Earls, Joey Carberry, Tyke Byrne, and then a load of basically academy and NTS boys that would never have probably imagined that they'd be training with the likes of these players. So it was interesting. It was interesting to watch the dynamic of the coaching group. And then also, and how positive they were. I thought that was brilliant. Cozzy was super positive in terms of bringing in those senior players and telling them like that they're effectively going to be coaches for the next week and a half to try and get these young lads up to speed. And they seemed to really take it. I was pleasantly surprised, I suppose, to see him take such a control and a reign. It was great to see the likes of Peter O'Mahony. You can see why he's so good.
How many players were there yesterday? Was it like 20, 25, 30?
No, was there was more. I think it was about 30. Yeah, the 250, the 15.
So they had all the academy basically there.
And NTS boys, so younger again. And then the seven internationals, the likes then of Chris Farrell is coming back into... and Damon D'Alande was there as well. So they had a good group.
Like. Did Chris Farrell train yesterday then?
He's on his way back in. So, yeah. But yeah, look, I just think for me, like you stand back and you watch, you can see why these guys are top internationals. Their ability to be able to bring the group together so good. Their ability to be able to communicate with those young lads, to be able to get them up to speed. And yeah, they're all systems go. I think they've really bought into the fact that this is the group now preparing for Wasps. And the coaching ticket looks really enthused and energetic. Treen Costello is coming from Wasps. So there's like, you know, what better man to know in terms of how they operate. He was their defence coach for years, their skills coach. Flipped over then to attack before he left. So he knows what Wasps are about. So I think if you're Van Gran, you're thinking like this group are in very good hands.
Yeah, really interesting stuff there from the Red 78. You can get that Niamh Briggs, who seems to have had a front row seat for training in Munster yesterday, and to see exactly how they're preparing. And as Rory O'Connor said in studio yesterday, it'd be the most Munster thing ever to get this team together and go and win a European Cup match and be like, yeah, we're Munster. Who are you? So that's the crack. John Duggan is with us in studio. John, good morning to you.
Morning, Jaron Owen. How are we doing?
What's going on?
Well, I thought I felt like Rafa Benitez looked like a gumshoe detective last night with a big anorak who had no idea where the scene of the crime was or what the answers were to the...
Where's the body?
What's the motive? And he was just completely lost. And I felt very sorry for him after that worst defeat in the Merseyside derby for 39 years for Everton against Liverpool, a 4-1 defeat last night.
Hey, look, you know, it's going to be some comeback story when he writes it.
I was a blackjack player in a former life, and the croupier always said to me, one of the best pieces of advice I got was, it's not how much you're up or you're down, because you do go through waves in blackjack at being up and down, it's when you leave. And Carlo Ancelotti knew when to get out of Everton. And now he's in Real Madrid.
I mean, it's mad. He went to Real Madrid from this. He managed to somehow... Yeah, things aren't going great. I'll take the Everton job and spin it that I'm a genius here.
I hope I'll always have that career reputation where when things don't go so well, I'll just walk into a job that's of the lustre of Real Madrid. I'm just going through Mashiri since he joined the club. 7th, 8th, 8th, 12th and 10th since he started his ownership of the club. Benitez is 6th manager. He was only allowed to spend 1.7 million this summer, Benitez. I don't think it's his fault.
He got the worst deal, didn't he?
Yeah.
He didn't get to buy any of his own players, really.
No.
And the players who were there previously, his best players, are all injured. So,
like Iwobi, Moise Keane, their net loss in transfers over three seasons was 157.3 million before this year.
It ain't the managers that are the problem in that situation.
Marcel Brands has a few questions to answer, I think.
The last Clásico that was played was between two managers who were formerly Everton managers.
Yeah. Like
they have to be
mad.
They have to be above some of the traditional Big Six teams, above a lot of them in terms of highest profile managers over a period of time, right? Like, I mean, you bring in the two of them, Big Sam, David Moyes, obviously, Roberto Martinez.
Koeman is a fluke. That is a how Koeman failed up consistently in his career is mad. It's unbelievable.
It kind of is, I guess. Like, the Netherlands thing, I guess, is the reason why he got the Barcelona job as opposed to the Everton job.
Well, it's a club legend, wasn't it? That Barcelona, that was one of the reasons as well. And also, he was a disciplinarian and he could be kind of mean to Messi.
But that worked out really well, didn't it?
Yeah.
Like, they got rid of Suarez, who promptly won the league for Atletico. Wow, that's well done, buddy. You're a genius. Well done. Congratulations.
Barcelona and Real Madrid are stuck in the 80s now. That's where they are.
I think Real Madrid have got loads of good kids. Like, I think actually Real Madrid could cause damage. I think Vinicius is maturing. The rate at which he's scoring versus the shots has vastly improved this season on last season. He's a wunderkind, and Benzema is still going to score goals. Luka Modric is still playing great football. Like, I think Real Madrid are going to be dangerous. I'm not saying they're going to win it, but I think they're going to be, like, they're going to knock out a team who everybody thinks is better than them.
Well, I think the best three teams in the world now are Chelsea, Man City and Liverpool. Like, some of the goals, the quality of the football at the moment in the Premier League is just off the scale in my mind. Like, Bernardo Silva's goal last night was just a breathtaking strike, and all the Liverpool goals were great, all four of them. The precision of Salah, 19 goals now in 19 games for him. Liverpool have scored more than two goals in their last 18 matches.
They're pretty good, aren't they?
It's just a joy to watch. I know people have their issues with the Premier League and the ownership of the clubs and all that, but I can separate myself from watching the quality of the football.
Yeah, no, it's true. As we keep saying, sports washing works because the product is sensational.
Yes.
Let's talk about Rory McIlroy, the Manchester United of golf.
Well, that's what he's comparing himself to. And he's at the Hero World Challenge in Bahamas this week. So let's hear from him now.
I guess it's a bit like we sort of talk about like Manchester United over the last few games have looked like they've been going out playing and not really having a strategy or a philosophy of how they want to play. And that sort of felt like that was me for a few months of this season. And now I feel like I've regained like what my philosophy is and what my, you know, what I basically the sort of golf that I want to play. So it was just getting back to being really clear about that. And I think that's really helped my confidence.
So it was a long press conference. He did about 18 minutes. So he spoke about that, and I'll come to that in a second. But he also got irked by questions about the fact that he ripped off his shirt after his poor finish at the DP World Championship.
It didn't take... I mean, I pulled on my collar and it ripped. I don't know if I've ever done it again or done it before. I went to the pro shop, bought a new one, threw that one in the trash. I mean, this ripped shirt like a Jesus.
Ooh. Ooh. Now that was a splicing of two answers
like
together.
Kids.
But like the reporters, which, well, what about the, you know, a bit like you ripped the shirt a bit, and he wasn't too happy about the questions.
I mean, he's a professional sports person who was very, very annoyed with his performance, and he tugged at something and it ripped. Like, was there a chance that the ripped shirt thing did get overblown a little bit, and that Rory's completely in the right here?
No, this is the Rory McIlroy soap opera. What are you talking about, Owen? Come on.
Like, it's all called golf. Golf players don't rip shirts, do they? It's so genteel.
Yeah, well, unless Bryson like takes a spinach and it pops like Popeye.
Mm.
Manchester United comment is interesting, though. Obviously, not an Ole Inn fan.
No, he's a big United fan, isn't he, Rory? Remember when he brought the claret jug into Old Trafford in that horrendous suit there a few years ago? But look, sure, I'm just jealous of people who can wear great suits. But look, he's at the Hero World Challenge this week, and I'm just kind of thinking to myself, do I put Rory in my staking plan now for the Masters? That's Rory. That's one of my thought processes already this far out.
I'd say no. He also talked about the Saudi Arabian golf thing and how they don't want to be used as pawns in the deal.
Yeah. Look, he has played golf with Trump. So... the Saudi thing, once again, we're talking about sports washing here. I think one interesting thing about Rory is, and all the European Tour players, they're very much behind this new DP World Tour, and they're very much behind almost the circling of the wagons that's gone on in golf between the PGA Tour and the former European Tour, and making that a world event. And I think that has actually put the kibosh in the Saudi thing.
Yeah. All right, John, good stuff. Thanks a million for that. John, back with us on Saturday afternoon from 1 o'clock on Off the Ball on News Talk. It is 8:55 this morning. If you want to get in touch with us, 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number. Or, of course, you can always get us at Off the Ball AM. Time for us to turn our attention to rugby. And I'm delighted to say Ronan O'Gara is with us this morning. Ronan, good morning to you. How are you?
Hey, Jar, how are you doing?
Yeah, good. There's been a, it's not a controversy, but it's a discussion point this week about Harry Byrne, who isn't getting his game for Leinster at the moment, obviously, but came off the bench for Ireland. And the pecking order has been fairly well established. He's behind his brother for Leinster, but seems to be ahead of him for Ireland. So what do you do in this situation if you're Harry Byrne, if you're advising him? Like, what can you do to try and catapult yourself forward to get more game time so you're in the conversation to play more for Ireland?
I think there's a few bits to that, Ger. I think the fact was, well, I'm very much on the outside, but reading from afar, I thought he was injured. And if you're injured, you don't present on a Monday available for selection. So in that regard, it's a very different, I suppose, agenda or discussion in terms of what's available for the weekend. I think what we're missing completely in the context of this discussion is that Ross Byrne has been very performing for Leinster in a lot of big games, and he's got the best out of his teammates on big occasions. If I recall, Exeter away, I think in a European Cup game, was Ross, I suppose, the conductor of that team. So it's a hugely competitive position, obviously, with Johnny Sexton there, with Ross Byrne there, and with Harry Byrne now looking to make an impact. But I think what has happened, obviously, is that Ireland realised that for World Cup planning in 24 months' time, Harry Byrne looks a juicy option for the Irish team. For that to happen, his development needs to be accelerated. It'll be accelerated at international level, but what happens in this position, Jar, is you get better the more minutes you play and the more mistakes you make. But from a Leinster's coaching point of view, they are judged in the now and on what happens in the short term. So for Leinster or for Ireland development, it becomes probably a secondary issue. They want silverware.
There was a great comment on our YouTube channel from a guy called Jim Demp. He says, Harry is 23 soon and only a couple of minutes under his belt this season for Leinster. Marcus Smith is roughly the same age and has played 113 times for his club. I checked the ages. Marcus Smith is 22. He'll be 23 on Valentine's Day, and a month later, on April 22nd, 2 months later, on April 22nd, Harry Byrne will turn 23. So there's 2 months in age difference, and Marcus Smith has played all those games. There's obviously different ways for different players. They mature at different stages, but one of the downsides of the Irish situation is that there is a pathway that is very established where you've got to knock off somebody who is a World Player of the Year if you want to get game time in the big European Cup matches. And maybe we need to revisit that as a strategy, like loaning him out for a year. Is that the worst idea?
Yeah, well, exactly. But you're coming back to two models that are probably incomparable. The strength of the Irish model is the everything is done towards getting your players performing for Ireland. The strength of the English model is that they have history and pride, and the French model in having a league that they go after hard. Marcus Smith is an out half in one of whatever there is, 14, is there 16 clubs in the Premiership, and then there's a Championship, and you mean, so in that league there's probably opportunity for 50 out halves. In Ireland there's opportunity for max 12 out halves, because you have the four provinces and four multiplied with three out halves, and each province gives you probably a window where you can have probably two probably definite tens in your squad, and maybe a kind of a hybrid 10-12 that can play there and that can play in the centre as well. So you know, I think this is old news in that regard, Ger. What is becoming more and more obvious now is that when your path is blocked in one of the provinces, young professionals coming into the game, they need to have a look. They need to develop their game. You don't get better by being in the gym. You get better by playing games. Yeah, you can get better by being in a really good environment and learning from other players, but that probably lasts maybe 12 months. Then all the stuff that you've learned on the training pitch, you got to put that into practice in a game situation. So for me, I think there is so much in what we're discussing that we could take absolute hours upon hours to trash out, but it keeps coming back to a few key points about the strength of the Irish model is that you have local players who have immense pride in playing for Munster, Leinster, Ulster and Connacht, and that if you try and dilute that, it really will dilute the provincial game. And the provincial game, we've seen that, I suppose, from an economic point of view, from a sporting point of view, all the benefits that's brought to the game in Ireland, but from opportunities to play, they are quite limited. And the reality is, if you're starting out half for the province, you have a fair chance of being involved in your national team. If you're starting out half for a club team in France or a club team in England, you could be a long, long, long way away from playing for your national team.
Do we need to revisit the model a little bit, though? Like, I get the strength and I understand that everybody and the game management and all that kind of stuff. But, for example, when you guys had those conversations with Jack Crowley, would it not have benefited Irish rugby for them to say, OK, here's a long-term deal for you, Jack, and we're going to loan you out to La Rochelle for a season and see how you get on? Like, do we need to just think a little bit more laterally about certain scenarios and certain positions even? Like, if there are young tight-head props coming up who are never going to play for Ireland?
Yeah, exactly. And I think this is what's great, being involved in sport and something you love doing. I think everyone needs to be managed individually. Can that happen? I think it can, because it just needs time. But once you have time and you put care and individual programs into people, I think you get a huge response from people, or from players, should I say. And I think people who are probably secure and who have growth mindset, they share ideas and they want to get better and they want to see all their players getting better as well. So I think in that regard, discussions should always be ongoing for what's best for A, the player, but also for both teams. There's a situation where, in my club recently, you had an international player who was lacking game time, and because it was international window, it was an opportunity for him to play minutes with us. And then he could present himself for international game. But having played 40 minutes for 6 weeks and then to go into a test match, I don't think anyone benefits. And that's the individual management of the player and the welfare of the player that needs to be looked after, because you're not dealing with robots or objects or pieces of meat. These guys have emotions, they're players, they need to be listened to, and we need to map out a really, really good strategy for them to get the best out of them.
One of the other things that's struck me this week, Ronan, in the aftermath of last weekend for Harry Byrne, is just that there's much more of a microscope on him. There's more criticism out there of Harry Byrne, and I guess you would have an insight into that in terms of the early stages of your career. Like, what is that like for a young out half realizing, okay, right, there's a lot more attention on me and every little mistake that I make is going to be picked up on and commented on?
Yeah, it's a great point, and I think it's something that a lot of us retired players forget. The formative years are very difficult because you don't have that bank of confidence. It's easy looking back and saying, I remember that period, but now young old halves are in that. And I can remember vividly where, you know what I mean, my mood on a Saturday was dependent, or on a Sunday was dependent by what the journalist wrote on a Sunday morning about my performance. And as you get a little bit older and wiser, you understand that the time constraints for the journalists to perform this, it's quite difficult for them in that regard, that they're taking a snapshot of the game and they're putting pen to paper, or nowadays typing it and getting that out to the market on that night. So I think the players are very, very fragile, and I think we all talk about their mental strength, but the impact of the social media has a huge impact on players. Obviously nowadays I think there's better mechanisms for players to cope with, in terms of, I think their support network would be stronger, but I still haven't met a player who likes bad things written about them.
No, and the other thing is that there are so few games now, particularly in Ireland, where there used to be games that were kind of off Broadway during the November internationals where players could get form or make mistakes, and nobody was really watching them that much. But every single match now, the best team tends to get selected more often than not, because the league season is a bit shorter and everything becomes a referendum. Like every time Harry Byrne gets the ball from now on, everybody's like, ooh, if he makes a mistake, well, he can't go in the Ireland team. Or if he does something great, it's like, stick him in straight away. And it's going to be the same for Joey Carberry the next time he plays for Munster. There's an uptick in form. We're all very hopeful that things are going to go well for him. But the level of pressure ratchets up. They're supposed to be able to deal with that because they're supposed to be our outhouse in the World Cup quarterfinal or wherever it is. And that's what we want. But I don't know. It feels like there's almost too much riding on every single thing at the moment when actually form comes over a 3 or 4 month period.
Yeah, I peel that back, Gerard. I think that's I wouldn't advise that as a performance measure for these guys. I think it depends on what environment you create for them daily. I think if they're feeling pressure about every moment in a game, then they're already broken. It's over for them. I would feel to probably counterattack on your point that every game is broadcast, but you've got to understand too the amount of players that Leinster use, so it's not always their first team, but like they have a strong team week in week out. But if Harry Byrne or Frawley and these guys want to play test rugby, they have to understand that test rugby is going to be another level up, so they should be feeling comfortable at this level. But I think it would be the wrong mindset to say, well, if I make a mistake here, that could penalise me. I think you've got to get to a state where you probably have your objectives understood and what you want out of this game before you attack it on a Saturday, individually and collectively. And then you probably get into a mindset or a state of flow where you get on to an instinctive feel about your game and you go play. You kind of, there's a reason why we repeat things in training so that you're able to do it when the pressure of the game comes. But some people actually do it better when they're put into game mode, because the adrenaline is there, and obviously the buzz of the crowd is there, and that's what separates people who are able to perform under pressure than who aren't. I remember playing with lots of guys in my career who were brilliant Monday to Friday, and then Saturday they just couldn't deliver.
The point you made there, I suppose, about the environment is right, isn't it? That if the coaches and the coaching ticket and the general management are all earning their corn, then that'll remove a little bit of that sense of my whole entire career rests on whether or not I find touch with this next kick.
Exactly, Gerard. You've got to remember, you play the game because you love it. You go to Leinster, to La Rochelle every day because it's something you love doing. But if you're thinking of making mistakes, then, wow, that for me is a warning sign straight away. It's not a job. This guy's, you're lucky to be involved in playing rugby. You go up there, you have to have fun. You have to express yourself. Yeah, there's 4 points. There's relegation every week, but if you're going to be kind of them, or if they're going to be kind of circling around in your head already, you have a negative mindset. You can't express yourself. It's not that should never exist in your culture.
One of the things that Conte Pomi said this week was that Leinster don't lose a lot of games, so that when they do, it's a real opportunity to dig down into the analysis and to get into the review pretty deep, which maybe if you are Harry Byrne and you've made those errors in a defeat, you're kind of bracing yourself for, as I say, a pretty deep review that could be a little bit scathing, I guess.
Errors are always part of the game, Owen, and especially for a number 10. I think what you'd find, when you're young, you make more. People ask what experience is. Experience is when you're in the same situation next week. Harry Byrne does not make the exact same mistakes he made 7 days ago. If that repeats over a cycle of two, three weeks, as a coach and as fellow players, you begin to go, is this guy getting the message, or has this guy the capacity to read pictures live in front of him and deal with the scenario? I would be pretty surprise from anyone involved in at that level getting opportunities for Leinster that they have consistent errors. It just doesn't, I haven't seen it.
Ronan, I just want to ask you about Sean O'Leary, who passed away yesterday. You're just about the right age to remember his last great flush as a the 1984 final when you were about seven, I think. He is part of that team that ends a famine in Cork terms, what they thought was a famine at that time. And obviously Tomás, his son, would have played a lot of rugby with you as well. So do you have any memories of Sean O'Leary?
I do. Yeah, my dad texted me yesterday and it hit me like a ton of bricks. I wasn't expecting it at all. I knew he was in hospital a lot recently, getting dialysis with his kidneys. But to get the text, it was shocking. Obviously, Tomás was very popular in the Munster dressing room, and we just given him an awful slagging that he was never anywhere near as good as his dad. But yeah, we all still, you know what I mean? Tomás would have been very, very, very proud of his dad, and he would have been very under the radar as well about Sean, the images of his dad. But he's a legend in Cork, very, very popular. And yeah, very sad day. I'm thinking of Tomás and his family, because it's really, really sad news.
Yeah, no, very shocking when it came through. He's only a young man at 69 as well. Before we let you go, how are things going? The meet and drink of the league is back. You're preparing for Europe as well. I presume most of your games are okay in terms of COVID at the moment, are they?
Well, there's been, there's a negative storm after coming in the last 24, 48 hours, a lot of cases, I think. So I think there's a new protocol in the top 14, which we're trying to get our heads around. Masks are back for everybody, and I think testing is back. So very uncertain times, but hopefully Europe obviously continues as planned. But unfortunately, a negative wave has come in, but we concentrate on obviously domestic rugby this weekend away to Stade Francais at 9:05 Sunday night, which is an interesting time for a game, and then into Europe the following week. So yeah, as you said, in my environment, Jared, it's not meat and drink. I'm a little bit more at stake.
Is the 9:05 Sunday night, is that in Paris or at home?
In Paris.
Right, and what do you do afterwards? Do you stay the night in Paris and come home, or do you get everybody?
Yeah. No, well, exactly, yeah. No, we let them all make their way home to La Rochelle. Do what you want, boys. See you Wednesday.
Oh, the fleshpots of Paris won't know what hits them. What could possibly go wrong for a rugby team?
Not under my strict management.
No steam being blown off. And one last question, the Munster scenario, obviously there's a potential that they're going to ask for some kind of derogation from the EPRC. Now, they might not need to, because it looks like they might squeak in with enough strength and depth to be able to fulfil the fixture. But Rory O'Connor was making the point yesterday that nobody is of a mind to be nice anymore in Europe after all the 28 nils last year, and particularly in France. If anybody comes looking to France for, hey, look, we're in a bit of trouble here, France will be like, well, hang on a second, look what you did to our lads last year. So is that true? Is there generally a look after yourselves here from this point on?
Oh yeah, it's ruthless, beyond ruthless, Ger. Just, I think I suppose sport differently. I think was it when the hand of God of Thierry Henry, wasn't it, the goal?
Yeah.
And Ireland applied to be the 33rd team or the 30?
Yeah.
In the absolute joy and laughter the French took out of that. It's just like, who are these guys? How can that happen? You know, there's just the result of the soccer game, that was it. It's over. And they were kind of, look at this small nation. What are they trying to do? Change the rules to be added in because of someone doing something unsporting in a game. For them, it's par for the course. It's just they get on with it. Over here, it's everyone for himself. You know, you got to make sure that you cannot ever count on a goodwill gesture. That's for certain.
But Henri sat on the grass beside Richard Dunn afterwards and said, I'm very sorry. So that makes up for it, right?
Well, sure, exactly. Sure, in rugby, sure. Kneel back as well. It's like, if he's playing for you, it's brilliant, you know? That's what happens, you know? I think these things, you got to you got to live with them. You know, it's the same in the European Cup final. We, in our game against Toulouse, you kind of have a guy poaching the ball. Nine times out of ten, it's a penalty. But what are you going to do? Sit there and start crying and write a letter to the European rugby that we were really hard done by there. It's just...
Can we have a cup as well?
Yeah, exactly. We have won it. We would have won it if we got the penalty.
Do you like have like a mechanism in your head at that moment, Ronan, that it's like the wheel will always turn or anything like that? Or is it, are you as cold and calculated as you are now, even in the heat of the moment?
It's a great question. You'd like to think there's karma, but I'm not too sure.
Ronan, good stuff. Enjoy wherever Paris takes you on Sunday night.
I'll enjoy the meat and drink of the top 14, Jared. See you later.
Good luck. Ronan McGarr on a Thursday morning there. That was pretty interesting. They're ruthless.
Yeah, they are. You gotta be. If you don't eat, you're gonna get eaten.
Here's what's coming up on the OTB Sports Radio channel for you today. OTB Gold is Jerry Eisenberg on Ali. Our Leaders Questions at 3 o'clock is Stuart Lancaster Leadership Podcast. Retro Panel is Caring for the Sports People, Sports Person. OTB Gold is Declan Murphy and Centaur. You should dig out on OTB Gold the interview that we've done with Ronnie Delaney there. It is 65 years to the day since he won Olympic gold in Melbourne. That is available on the OTB Gold podcast. Up next this morning on OTB AM, Harriet Pryor of the Anfield Wrap joins us to talk about the Merseyside Derby.
OTB AM.
Harriet Pryor of the Anfield Wrap is with us. Good morning to you, Harriet. I suspect that was a good night from your perspective last night.
Morning. Yeah, it was great fun. It was actually my first derby since I've moved up to Liverpool with sort of the fan and all the fans and all the buzz around it. So yeah, it was a very good night in the city. Sadly, I wasn't in the ground, but I think I had the next best thing just being here and soaking up all the atmosphere. So yeah, very good night.
Well, what is it actually like then? Because anytime I've been to Liverpool, it's never been for a derby, but it's been on match day and the city is obviously on fire when there's matches on. I can only begin to imagine what it's like on a derby day.
Yeah, I think it was a strange one actually, because I felt a lot of sense of anticipation in the city, mainly because I guess you don't know who's supporting who and where everyone's coming from, so you're a bit reluctant to sort of get excited about it and talk to people because you're not sure what team they're supporting and what side they're on. But mostly it was all good spirited and all good fun, but definitely an atmosphere in town for the last couple of days. Actually, I felt building up to it and looked like a great atmosphere in the ground as well. And yeah, I think it's always a fun time to be on the city on match day, but this derby has a different feel about it, and I think you could definitely sense that yesterday and maybe today as well. The celebrations will continue for half of us.
Did the Everton fans who left early stumble around to your section of the city at all afterwards?
No, they didn't actually. I mean, when we went in and we sat down, we were thinking, oh, is it going to be, we didn't know how much red and how much blue were going to be in the bar, but luckily in the bit we were in it was mostly red, so we all enjoyed it together.
Where does last night rank in the satisfaction levels for Liverpool fans in what has been a pretty successful recent history against Everton?
Yeah, I think I tend to think actually in the past when we've gone to Goodison, even when we've had really good seasons or we've had really good spells, we've actually struggled there. I think we've drawn the last four games we've actually been to Goodison, and we've never hit that second gear. So I think that's why there was a lot of sense of nervousness and anticipation last night about whether, even with the good form there and in there having a spell of poor form, and we're doing great at the moment, whether we could make that translate into a good result last night. And we did, and emphatically so. And a lot of people were saying, oh, you know, we'd love that last minute winner like Mane and that Origi goal in the derby and stuff. But sometimes it's just quite nice to get into the last 10 minutes and just sit back and enjoy it. So it was definitely a great result, and definitely ranks very high with all the other last minute winners and everything. And it was great to do an emphatic style. And they just showed that they have that other gear. I think since we've come back from the international break, we've just continued to crack on, keep on working hard. And I think last night you really saw the result of that.
Go on. I was just going to ask that other gear that you mentioned there. Is there a case to be made that gear is actually a level above Manchester City's and Chelsea's top gear? Like, maybe not consistently over the season, given the depth that those two clubs have in the squad, it may not lead to them winning the title, but that top gear, if everybody's going full throttle, do Liverpool have an extra edge?
I think that's really interesting because it's become quite clear, hasn't it, over the last two match days that it has become a bit of a three-way race between the three of those teams that you mentioned. And all three of them have different strengths and different weaknesses. And we've seen this season already that they are capable of dropping points in different ways against different styles of teams. The squad depth is an interesting one. Obviously, Chelsea are scoring a lot of goals from defence. There's questions about whether that is sustainable or not and whether they can keep that up. I think Liverpool have shown that at times our game management isn't the best. Manchester City are always consistent, but they have dropped points. And so, you know, I don't know whether we are going to be the ones that can reach that other gear. But I think what's going to be key for the team that goes on and ultimately wins the league is finding a level of consistency over a period of 10, 15 games where they are just consistently grinding out the wins, however they are coming, just keeping to score goals. And I'm hopeful that Liverpool are the team that can do that. I mean, our goal scoring ability at the moment is absolutely ridiculous. We've scored 43 goals in the league this season, and that's more than any other side across Europe's top five divisions. So there's no shortage of that. It's just whether we can keep the defence tight, keep people fit, keep players fit. And if so, then yeah, I totally believe that we can maintain this level and go on to do it all.
That point about the three teams, they're actually totally different teams as well. Like I definitely think that there's a case we made that City's highest level is as high as Liverpool's highest level, and that'll get borne out one way or the other over the course of the rest of the season. The thing that I'm interested in is what happened in the international break, because the performances before that did include the defeat to West Ham and what must have felt like a defeat in the 2-2 draw against Brighton, where the team are cruising and it looks like it's going to be a routine 3-4 victory, and it didn't happen. But they look like a totally different side now. So what are the working theories at the moment about what has happened and what's changed?
You know, it's really interesting because after the international break, when we had that game to West Ham, everyone was really negative about the fact that they were going to be going away playing for their international teams. I personally saw it a little bit differently. I thought it gave them a chance to take their mind off of club football when they got into a bit of a rut and they were finding it hard to get through games. I mean, it's ridiculous that we're talking this way after just two games, but it did feel like that because that's the standard you expect as a Liverpool fan. I think maybe just going away, getting that bit of headspace, Klopp allowing them to just have a bit of time away from club football has just massively helped. Klopp hates the international breaks more than anyone in the world. He really does. But I do think in this occasion it has sort of helped because there's just been a complete reset and Klopp has been able to come in, say to the players, right, we're going to start again now and we're going to crack on and we're going to show that those two games are not representative of how we play our football and how this season is going to go. And I think they've really shown that. But ultimately, I think with Liverpool and the mentality that they have and that the manager has, they just try and work every single game as an individual basis and play the opponent, not the occasion. And Klopp was really, really wanted to make that clear last night that he didn't like all the context around it and the contextualisation around the derby and the vibe that it has. He just wants to go and play their football. And on their day, if they're in the game, they are good enough. I think injuries, you have to say, also have played a part. And we had a few midfield problems before the international break. The breaks allowed some of those players to come back and we're able to play a stronger team and have a bit of more squad depth and options off the bench. So that's also been a really positive impact. But definitely a bit of a mentality shift and the combination with players coming back has helped a lot.
Those comments that you mentioned from Klopp in the build-up to the game were very much mirrored in his comments after the game. Like he said, it was the best performance we've showed at Goodison since I've been at Liverpool. We were never as calm or convinced as we were tonight, and that's why we won. He says we were an emotional football team, but first of all, we need the right mindset. Emotion is good, but not the all-important thing. Is that in itself a shift, Harriet, from tapping into the unbelievable emotion at the football club?
Yeah, definitely. We all know that Liverpool and the fan base and the club and the mentality around it is a very emotional thing. It's a very emotional connection. They get their connection off of the fans, and that's why they struggled so much last season without them. So that there's no denying that they feed off of that and they need that. However, there's a huge case to be made for not letting that become the overriding factor, especially when you're playing in these huge games, when you're playing against United, when you're playing in the derby. You cannot let the emotions of the occasion get to you, because otherwise you'll never go and play your best football. And I think that's at times what we've seen in the past. We've let things get to us, and the intensity of the game and the fact that they always come out and try and come out very strong against us. And we've obviously, we know what happened last season with the Van Dijk injury that sort of set the season on a bit of a downward spiral. So Klopp last night will have been so proud that they just went and played their football as he knows they can and didn't let the rest of it get to him. And that shift in mentality is really, really important on big match days. And this season, they just seem to be nailing it on those days and winning 4-0 against United and winning 4-1 last night.
Not bad.
And, yeah. No, it's not bad. That's the thing. And that's why I think when we think about like a one loss to West Ham, I think we're pretty lucky really, aren't we?
Do you think he got in the heads of Everton as well with the pre-match comments about the aggressive football and because the game didn't take off from Everton's perspective until they were 2-0 down, by which stage it was too late?
Yeah, definitely. I like to think that Klopp was just completely focused on what their game plan was and what they had to do, and maybe, you know, Rafa saw it as a bit of an opportunity to get a bit of a foothold back because his results haven't been good there, and he'll want to show his commitment to the club, especially in a game like last night, but also show improvement. So he thought a derby was the perfect opportunity to do it. It obviously didn't turn out that way. I mean, Liverpool was straight out in the first 20 minutes and it was so convincing. And when it went to 2-1 and we let them back in the game, obviously there was a nervous 10 minutes, but straight back out in the second half and we always looked like we were on top. And definitely that always helps, isn't it? When you come out, you quieten the crowd, you make sure the atmosphere isn't in their favour. And we saw that last night straight away. I mean, we could have scored very early on with the chances that we had. And then we just cracked on and it was great to see.
Are Liverpool fans singing for Rafa Benitez at the end because they love him or because they love him being the Everton boss?
Oh, to be honest, when it happened and when he went to Everton, I don't think there was much love lost. And there was in some parts of the fan base, and everyone obviously is entitled to have different opinions on it. For me, I saw it more as a business decision and a business thing for him. And, you know, he just wanted to live in Liverpool ultimately, and he got a job that allowed him to do so and paid him quite a lot of money. I don't think there's... I don't want to really get involved in that because it's just not something that I would maybe get involved in even if I was in the ground. But, you know... We can't want Rafa to do well when he's at Everton. That's what I will say. We're never going to want that. So last night when things like that happen, people like to say, well, we did warn you.
So Rafa, you want to see him get the sack? You want to see Everton in the relegation zone?
You want to see him stay there for as long as possible. That's what I'm hearing. It's like Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. Ole's at the wheel.
I think there were a few Rafas at the wheel chance last night, but I wasn't there, so I can't confirm or deny. But
I did predict that on yesterday's show that the Liverpool fans would be singing Rafas at the wheel at the end of that. What's the story with the Salah contract? Because every week that they wait, the money gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And if they don't do it, the crushing loss to the fan base is going to be even more difficult to explain.
It's a weird one. It's a weird situation. It was one that was really ramping up over the summer. There was a lot of talks about it getting over the line, especially in the early parts of the season. And now it's sort of gone quiet a little bit. And he continues to show us every single week why he deserves it, show the club every single week why he deserves it. Last night, absolutely phenomenal again. And the positions he finds himself in, the anticipation to know when other teams are going to maybe make a mistake and for him to be there to capitalise on it. I want him to stay at the club for as long as possible. I think he's still got his peak for many years to come, and he's still got other levels to go to. I genuinely believe that, which is what kind of scary. The club have to sort it out. They know that. We all know that. We know something's got to get done. I think it will get done. I believe it will happen. I think that the terms are just a lot harder because of the nature of how good he is. So it will take longer to agree a contract that everyone's happy with. But I think ultimately the club know that if they let Salah go, it would be a huge mistake and it would cause a huge upset between the fan base. So I don't think they want to get into a situation where that happens and there's any resentment towards it. So I'm hoping they get it done sooner rather than later, but only time will tell. And I think we've still got to wait a little bit longer for that to happen.
When Thiago signed, we did a couple of pieces around that time that did massive numbers because the level of expectation was so great. It was like, oh, here is a piece that's going to transform our team. And then injuries and illness and loss of form. And now all of a sudden it's like, ah, we told you so. to use your words, his form at the moment is actually transforming a little bit about what they can do in terms of being able to keep possession and not just kill you with, I mean, obviously last night was a bit different because there was several goals in the break and through balls into space, but they didn't need to do that. They could have, they can now play a different way with Thiago and the team.
Yeah, when Thiago first came in, there was a huge amount of excitement around it, and I totally agree. For the first season he was there, he didn't show what we thought he was capable of. A lot of that had to do with the players around him, and you can only be really as good as the team around you, especially when you're a player like Thiago who needs that creative flair and that ability to push forward. Now that he's got that strong defence behind him, he's got Fabinho in behind him, is that holding midfield position, he is just being allowed to go and do what he does best, which is be creative, assist, make the ball before the goal, score goals in the last few games as well. And we're finally seeing, I think, the best of Thiago. He has been a bit plagued by injuries and illnesses, and obviously you need to allow new players a grace period to settle into the team, settle into the new league. He's had a season to do that now. He's finally getting consistent starts, and he's finally in that midfield three that I think Klopp would have wanted to play for a long time alongside Fabinho and Henderson. And you can just see that it's all gelling. And Liverpool's midfield is a really, really hard place to play, simply because of the way we play football and the way we play our high defensive line. And so settling into that does take a little bit longer, but now you're finally just seeing how good he is. And oh my God, how good again was he last night? I could talk about Thiago all day, I think. I'll stop myself now.
What about Jota? Because his rich vein of form has perfectly coincided with Firmino's injury. And it's like, I don't know if Bobby Firmino's getting back in this team.
Yeah, there's always a lot of conversations around the two players and whether they're competing for a position. I don't see it quite like that, because I think you need more than three strikers to go on a 38 game season and do well, and obviously Champions League and football and everything as well. But obviously we are absolutely delighted that he came in literally the same time as Thiago, and there wasn't as much anticipation and excitement around what he could do, and he has proven that there absolutely should have been, because he's been unreal for us. He's growing in confidence game on game, week after week, and you can just tell he's absolutely loving his football. His strength and dynamism last night to get that fourth goal, I mean, it was literally an impossible angle and he made it look so easy, and I'm loving watching him play. I'm loving that he gets random little headers that you just don't expect from him. It seems to just keep scoring without having to do anything, reinvent the wheel. He's just playing his own style of game, and he's a great option to have when we don't have Firmino, and you can't complain about that. When Firmino's fit, obviously I think it provides a bit more competition between the two. They're going to be constantly pushing each other to do better, so it's no bad thing to be competing for a position and to have another player who can do as well as you can when you're out. So it's only going to push them both on, but yeah, Jota's been very, very impressive for us.
All right, Harry, we'll let you go. Thanks a million for joining us. Cheers.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Harriet Pryor of the Anfield Wrap there. A little bit earlier on, of course, in the ad break before that, you would have heard some of the Ireland-Georgia analysis on this week's Koi Gig Pod. We had Karen and Kathleen, who were joined by former Ireland captain Emma Byrne. Emma Byrne wasn't actually on that part, but she also was on a little bit later on talking about the issues around the goalkeeping in the Ireland squad. So if you're unfamiliar with Emma Byrne's career, it was an unbelievable career where she was the goalkeeper for Ireland and Arsenal for the best part of 15 years and has like a gazillion caps. She was making the point that we should be able to recruit from Gaelic football in particular. And that always made sense to me. It kind of feels like it's the type of position that the FAI could just start hiring 17, 15-year-olds and putting them through some kind of academy system and then farming them out to have a centralised contract for the position of goalkeeper from that age. And like, maybe the right thing to do is actually just pay goalkeeping coaches to go and work professionally with all of our underage national teams, and then also to work with the women's league clubs. That might be a better use of resources, but to hothouse a couple of players perhaps who have a combine style AFL recruitment thing where those talent identification things that they also do for other sports, where you find that the cyclist becomes a rower and all that kind of stuff. Like, just do that and have that and say, do you want a career as a full-time professional goalkeeper? Are you aged between 15 and 19? And let's just steal some players from other sports.
Like, it could be something that works beyond the goalkeeping position, to be honest with you. It's actually a plan that makes a little bit of sense, that you'd imagine there'd be a good bit of transferable skills regardless. But if you manage to nail that position, you've got a pretty good start, needless to say. Obviously, the sense that I'm getting a professional contract is going to be very attractive to anybody who's never got a hope of that, if they're going to just focus on Gaelic games for the rest of their life. So,
well, some of our best players are going to Australia.
Well, there is
maybe
there is
some of our best players could go and play for Ireland.
Yeah.
Anyway, that conversation that obviously Emma Byrne knows way more about this than I do, and she's suggesting that there's transferable skills, that was with Karen Duggan and Cathy McNamee on this week's Koi Gig Pod. The bit that we heard them talking about was obviously, let's not get carried away with the 11-0. The same concerns are still there after the Slovakia game. And the Koi Gig Pod, it's our weekly podcast about the women's international football team and the women's league and the women's league in England as well. And the cup final this weekend has Irish interest in it with Katie McCabe and Arsenal as well. It's all in association with Cadbury FC, official snack partner to the Republic of Ireland women's national team. Full episode is available to podcast right now and every Tuesday on the OTB Sports app. Just search for the OTB Football podcast feed. Tomorrow morning, Adrian and Owen in studio. Paul Galvin is going to join us. We'll have reaction to Arsenal Manchester United. We'll hear from Alan Quinlan as well. That's after the head of the game in Tralee this weekend.
Yeah.
The Clásico, what's it called?
It was just the El Clásico of Tralee was just what I saw it referred to as in the...
You need something better than that, right?
We need something better than that. It hasn't happened in a long, long, long time.
Stacks versus, what's the name of the...
Cairns O'Reilly's.
Cairns O'Reilly's is a divisional team. No.
Cairns O'Reilly's are a club.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
St. Brendan's are the divisional team around there.
Grant. So it's an all Tralee final, but Stacks are already through to the Munster Club Championship.
No.
This got through?
Yeah, yeah.
Ah, okay.
Two club teams. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It would be different if they were up against a divisional team because they are the team who's got furthest in the county championship and are champions of the club championship. Clear as mud.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sorry. I got, I talked myself into
a
level
all
of confusion.
This
I didn't need to. Okay, right. So proper nonsense. And you need a name. Give it a name.
Yeah, it's
this
true.
Is your chance.
Any Tralee based pun artists out there, get in touch.
Right. OTBA, I'm brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors.
OTB AM.
With Gillette, put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.